Ready to go? Okay. We're going to go ahead and call the meeting to order of the Arizona Board of Podiatric Medical Examiners at 8:33 a.m. on November the 17th, 2020. I will ask Heather to just repeat who she has present on the call that are appearing telephonically.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I have Dr. Patrick Farrell, Dr. Foreman, Dr. Saunders, complainant DR, complainant TF, Dr. Ulano, Dr. Houston, Libby Peterson, Mr. Kenneth Moscow, Dr. Rosales, and Kim Evans. And I believe that we may have had another participant just join the call.
Yes, Ryan Skyver.
And are you here for a specific agenda item, Mr. Skyver?
I am. The Faustina V. Clark.
Okay. So any, if you're a complainant, then any complainant should just address themselves by using their initials only?
I'm an attorney.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
And who is that for?
And you're representing Dr. Clark?
No. Faustina, I have another case against Clark for...
Okay.
One of the other ones. Yeah.
The complainant in Dr. Clark's case.
Yeah, I don't represent the complainant. I'm just interested in the outcome of this case.
I understand. Okay, thank you.
And what was the name again, Heather?
Mr. Ryan Skyver.
Ryan Skyver. All righty. All right. Does anyone on the board have any declarations, any conflicts of interest they'd like to report for this meeting? All righty. And we do have, well, we're going to pass right now on the minutes and move on to our timed item, which is an informal hearing. The complaint number is 20-04-C, Dr. Erica Huston, who is present telephonically. Her counsel, Mr. Bruce Crawford, is present, and we also have a witness here, Dr. Freed, and we also have the complainant DR or DB present on the line?
I don't believe so.
Okay. Thought he was going to be calling in. All right. Just a minute here. This keeps flipping around on me. Just a second, please. Dr. Polakoff, are you present? We need Dr. Polakoff because that's a...
I just emailed her.
Okay. Well, pardon me, gentlemen. We're going to... actually, let's then, since we're waiting on our investigator, and we will see if the complainant is going to be present, I'm going to go back here to our number four, which is a review discussion of possible action on our board meeting minutes. Everyone has reviewed the minutes. Does anyone have any issues with those minutes?
No.
Thank you, gentlemen. If not, then I will make a motion to accept the general session minutes of October 21st, 2020 as written. Do I have a second?
Second.
Thank you. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Aye.
Thank you. So moved. Okay. We could look here then at... do we have doctors, any of the licensees on the issues of licensing? Do we have any of those doctors on the phone right now? Okay. Kind of holding things up here a little bit. Actually, we could take one of those. We have Dr. Brian Derner, who is the second under C, the issue of licenses. And Dr. Derner is currently in his residency training, and he does not expect to graduate till June 30th of 2021, but His application is complete as far as that paperwork. He's completed all his board examinations, and once he's completed with his residency, he plans to attend a fellowship, I believe, at Core Institute here in town. We do have the letter from the residency director that he will complete in July or June 30th of 2021. So at this time, I will make a motion to accept Dr. Durney's application for licensure, and the license will be issued upon evidence of successful completion of his residency.
Second.
Thank you, Mr.
Second.
Thank you. Does anyone have any discussion? All right, let's take a vote. All in favor? Aye.
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 Thank you. So moved. Our other applicant, Dr. Splitchell, wanted to be on the phone, but we don't have her on currently, so we'll have to go back to that. Let's see, some of our other issues we have here. Now, is Dr. O'Brien present on the line there, Heather? No. Could we, let's see here, move on to your executive director's report, Heather?
Yes, I can. I was going to try to step out of the room and call Dr.
Okay, O'Brien. Why don't we do that? Let's just take a break then from that. And thank you, everyone, for your patience while we, the wonders of.
You're welcome.
All right. Are we all, so we're all ready to get back on track here? Wonderful.
So.
All righty. Thank you again, everyone, for your patience. So we're going to go back now to our informal hearing, complaint number 20-04-C, Dr. Erica Huston. And at this time, we will go ahead and the procedure is easy to follow here. So we're going to go back on record here to begin this hearing at, looks like about 8, not quite 8:50 a.m. on the 17th of November 2020, and pursuant to ARS 32-852.01D, this is the informal hearing regarding Dr. Erica Huston in case number 20-04-C. And we, since Dr. Huston is just present telephonically, she obviously is not here in person. We also have her counsel, Mr. Bruce Crawford, is present. And we just have some questions we need to go through, Dr. Huston. And are you represented by legal counsel today? Dr. Huston?
Are you talking?
I am.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
So, yes, I am represented by Mr. Crawford.
Thank you so much. Can you please state your full name, please?
Erica Huston.
Thank you. Mr. Crawford, could you please introduce yourself?
Yes, Bruce Crawford of Crawford & Klein, representing Dr. Erica Huston.
Thank you, Mr. Crawford. I'm Dr. Barbara Campbell, president of the board and a professional member. The other board members will now introduce themselves and indicate whether they are a public member or a professional member. I'll begin with Mr. Rhodes here, sir.
I'm John Rhodes, and I'm a public member.
Dr. Ulano?
Dr. Albert Ulano, professional member.
Dr. Foreman?
Dr. Mark Foreman, professional member.
Thank you. Also present are our executive director, Heather Broaddus, and our board's assistant attorney general, Seamus Monahan. You've all received notice of this informing you of the matters that we will be discussing today, the process of the informal hearing, and possible actions the board may take. The purpose of this hearing is to inquire into facts and circumstances of the case and to decide an outcome. We've all read the board material submitted to us to date, and we will hear a brief overview of the case presented by the investigator, and then we will interview you, Dr. Huston. If you have any questions for the board or anyone providing information during the interview, you may ask them through me. And if you would prefer not to participate in this informal interview, you can also indicate this now, and the matter would be directed to a formal hearing. And of course, this is being recorded to provide a record, and everyone must speak loudly and clearly, and please only one person at a time. And we have to watch with phones, making sure you're on mute, because a lot of times we do get a lot of background information or a lot of background noise, and it's just kind of decreases the effectiveness of the hearing. And I know we also have Dr. Freed, who is present as a witness for Dr. Huston, and we will ask him to make a brief statement at the proper time. And if there are questions the board members would have of him, because I know you've all read his document that he presented, that you've read that, then we should be able to just briefly review that and ask any pertinent questions. But like I said, that will happen at the appropriate time. So I will ask at this time for Dr. Polakoff, the investigator, to give us a brief summary of the case. Dr. Polakoff.
Good morning, board. Thank you, Dr. Campbell. Good morning, board. In this case that I've reviewed and presented to the board, there were concerns that arose from the doctor's documentation stating that she has reviewed the chart, but the vascular test that was ordered by the nurse practitioner and on the chart was not reviewed until multiple months after the patient started treatment with Dr. Huston. The patient has claimed in his complaint that he was harmed because of the delay in treatment for the vascular study that was performed. Also, in addition to the concerns about not reviewing the chart and not reviewing the vascular study that was done, is the concern of coding for the 99213-25 visits. And the E&M code was billed without a separate and identifiable diagnosis used. Only in her notes, the separate treatment was a debridement treatment. So concerns arose about the billing for 99213s, the coding for the 11042, the debridement code of the right heel, the use of the 79 modifier, and also during her post-op care for the 11042, the care that is covered within the scope of the 11042 code is 10 days. But there was a bill processed for debridement during that 10-day period. I am concerned about the doctor not recognizing and reviewing the chart, as was stated with every visit that a chart was reviewed. And I did substantiate the complaint by the patient for delay of care due to a vascular study unreviewed by the doctor. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Polakoff. Reviewed the other materials that were presented in regards to the choice of the billing codes, the explanation as to why those were selected. What are your remarks on that? Do they satisfactorily describe that to you, and are you in agreement to those?
I'm sorry, just Dr. Campbell, there's a lot of noise in the background. So someone's making a lot of movement of papers or something.
Okay.
Hard to hear you.
Okay, sorry. I will repeat myself. In the supplemental information that was presented by Dr. Huston, that was in regards to explanations for the billing and having separate identifiable services on those visit days that were in addition to the debridements. And my question is, did that response, was that satisfactory in describing why those billings occurred the way they did?
No, ma'am, that's not satisfactory. I'd like to explain that again if she can.
Are you still having trouble hearing me?
I can respond.
Pardon me? Please respond, Dr. Polakoff.
I did not find that explanation satisfactory that Dr. Huston gave on the to substantiate her billing code.
Okay.
I'd like her to explain that during her part of the interview, please.
Okay, thank you very much. That was one component that I, and you've also obviously had time, you reviewed the other additional materials, but again, those are questions that we will have for Dr. Fried, that the board can address those questions. All righty, so do any of my board members have any additional questions for Dr. Polakoff at this time?
No.
Dr. Ulano?
No.
Okay, thank you so much, gentlemen. All right, so Dr. Huston, could you please?
Dr. Campbell, I have questions for Dr. Polakoff.
He can ask them through you.
Okay, you have to ask those through me, Mr. Crawford.
Okay, good luck.
How does that?
Well, I mean, he can't cross-examine through you, but if he does have questions of her, he can ask. Otherwise, we have to move to a formal hearing.
Right.
That's incorrect. Look at the Gavitt case. I'm specifically entitled to cross-examine the board's investigator.
That's not my office's understanding. And I have read the Gavitt case.
So,
okay, well, I'm going to read it. I'm being respectful, okay? Okay. This is it's footnote 22, I'm sorry, paragraph 22 of the Gavitt decision. Often a professional licensing board will have the case reviewed by a consultant who practices in the same area. In such an instance, as described in Webb, procedural due process mandates that the professional being investigated be provided a copy of the consultant's analysis and opinions, and upon request, be afforded the opportunity to confront those opinions through cross-examination.
It would be my opinion that those questions would be need to ask through the board chair.
Do you have a list of those questions, Mr.
I have my handwritten notes. I don't have a specific list. I didn't write out the questions like you would read them, Dr. Campbell. If you want me to, I can, but it's going to take twice as long for me to read these and then have you reread them to the doctor. So I did request before this started the right to question the board's witnesses, and I'm just following the Gavitt decision, which
right.
is the case, I think, on point, quite frankly.
I'll leave that up to the board's discretion.
If you will keep the questions to just a few minutes, Mr. Crawford, I will allow you to ask Dr. Polakoff, but just for 2 minutes.
Well, okay. I'm going to ask my questions, and then if you cut me off, I guess you cut me off. But Doctor, she's okay if I just direct her to her directly?
Dr. Polakoff, are you
yes?
ready to respond to Mr. Crawford's questions, please?
I'll listen to the question, and then I might need time to review this question, so I don't know how that's going to work.
Well, let's try and see if it Mr. Crawford.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Dr. Polakoff. It's Bruce Crawford. First off, you don't have any personal experience working in the Tucson Medical Center Wound Care Clinic in terms of how things worked there, what the communication was. Is that fair?
Excuse me, Dr. Campbell, I'd like a specific question. I don't think that that's a fair question. It's
okay, wait.
I mean, this is an informal hearing. It's not a hearing.
I know. Yes, that's true.
Informal.
That is true. It's if it's so desired that it be moved to that, that's, you know, if we're going to get into those kind of really direct questions, then it will go to a formal hearing. It will be mandated to a formal hearing. So I would ask Mr. Crawford, maybe can you direct your questions more on the line of how her conclusions were made? What determined her conclusions?
Okay, just for record purposes, then you're suggesting that Dr. Polakoff doesn't have to answer that initial question, I assume?
Yes.
Okay. Dr. Polakoff, the original referral, and this is materials you reviewed, the original referral to Dr. Houston on June 14, 2019 was for an offloading boot, is that right?
Dr. Campbell, I'm and Mr. Monahan, I have questions about. I don't think that this is an informal hearing. It's as if he's conducting question by question. Be specific as to questions in my report. No, Dr. Campbell, I don't feel comfortable answering these.
We make a motion to go into executive.
Yes. Okay, since we're having some questions here, I will ask, I'm making a motion to move into executive session for purposes of legal advice. Do I have a second?
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed?
Aye.
Thank you. So moved. We will go into executive session and return. So everybody, please just stay on the line. Board members, we will call you in a few moments.
140, which is incision and drainage, should not have been billed. That the documentation specifically states, underline hemorrhage noted left sub fifth met base. This appears stable with no soil. As he wrote in his chart, SOI, but I do believe that's discharge. Again, on 5719, additional lower extremity orthosis, soft interface for molded plastic, AFO plastic with ankle custom, was billed for $1,144.98, and the liner $171.56. This, unfortunately, is not covered by the patient's insurance. But I found no problem with the devices. I just found some problems with upcoding for some of the debridement and upcoding for the E&M code. And in some cases, the E&M code was not substantiated for an independent visit.
And you also know
again on 7/11/19. Just one more is 10140 incision and drainage hematoma was billed, but in the notes he states hemorrhage was reduced on this visit. Underlying hematoma was dry with no active drainage noted. So how could he bill for hematoma if it was dry and there was no drainage? That sounds like a callus or a scab. So I have listed in the report a few cases similar to that.
Right. Thank you. Do any board members have any questions for Dr. Polakoff? Dr. Foreman or Dr. Ilano, do you have any questions?
No, I have no questions.
Dr. Foreman, if you were trying to ask a question, it is not coming through. It's very garbled. It's still, you're
Hello?
Kind of breaking in and out. Okay, Mr. Rhodes, any questions, sir?
No question.
Thank you. Okay, Dr. Rosales, if you would like to give your statement or your attorney on these questions presented here from Dr. Polakoff's investigation, you can proceed, please.
And this is Ken Moscow, Dr. Rosales' attorney. I'll let Dr. Rosales and or Ms. Evans from his office respond. I may have something to add when they're through, though, if that's okay.
All right.
I sympathize with the patient and his wife in regards to the bill that was sent over. We definitely, in my opinion, went above and beyond to try to submit these claims to his insurance and make sure we submitted them in a proper way and went above and beyond and tried to appeal Medicare. But, you know, unfortunately, that's just the way the insurance works, and access doesn't cover what Medicare doesn't, you know. And we did everything we could. We tried to work with them. It just didn't work out. As far as the other billing concerns, I went through this stuff with my billing person here, Kim. So we kind of visited some of these things here, and we looked at the vascular studies that we did, and we looked at the definition that's provided on the CMS website, and it's, we feel that the 93923 is, you know, was submitted correctly, and it substantiates what was done. As far as the strapping code and the billing code, the Uniboot is, you know, actually billed more, and we billed a lesser of a code, and that's for the unlisted casting and strapping of a leg and foot. So we downplayed ourselves, and we made the bill less than what it should have been, and that's, again, to our detriment, but, you know, that's what we did. I understand the billing code is there. The substantiation for the 99203, there is a modifier there on the HICPA claim that was submitted, and I think the time and the energy that went into the note and generating it for someone that has multiple medical issues, I mean, there's no doubt that it substantiates billing the 99203, so I don't see that there's anything wrong with that. The incision and drainage, the 10140s and IMD, a hemorrhage is a bleed through the tissue. That's what a hemorrhage is. It's underneath the bony prominence, and the way that his foot was positioned and a foot drop with a varus position, that's where his area of concern was. And he did develop a blood blister under there. Sometimes it would be wet, sometimes it would be dry. The SOI is an abbreviation for no signs of infection, so there was no erythema or edema around the pre-ulcerative area, but he had a contusion there, and a contusion is a hemorrhage, and hemorrhages can be dry or wet, and his was dry in this instance. So I think that's the appropriate code to use there. As far as the other dates of service, say 5/9/19, which was something else that say we used the 99213 and it was not substantiated. It was a problem focused exam. But when you look at the patient's medical history, we're not just seeing him for one particular issue. I mean, he's got severe peripheral vascular disease, he's got venous insufficiency, he's got lymphedema, he's got chronic itching that was documented on that visit, and that's what we were seeing him for. We offered him Benadryl to try to negate the issues that he was having with that, which he declined treatment for. So, you know, I'm not randomly just selecting codes with no substantiation. And further down the line, I mean, same thing with the, you know, there's on the 7/11/19, we build another 99213. I mean, that definitely substantiates the time that I spent with a patient. We hadn't seen him in almost 2 months. So the fact that we didn't see him in 2 months, I mean, that in itself is grounds to stand on for, the office visit. And, you know, again, he, was billed for an IND of a hematoma because this was a problem area that we're continuing to try to treat and to try to offload with the brace that we got him and with the shoe modifications and with the inserts and with the, attempt to trying to reduce the amount of edema in his leg to get it back to a normal state so that we could get his foot to fit inside of his shoe properly. All this was done, with the patient's best interest in mind. And I have known these patients for years, and it's disheartening to me that has come to this, but I try to go out of my way, I think, to try to provide the best patient care. We have someone that's been in the office that has done the billing for years, and she has established a relationship with them and worked with them on end to make sure that we go to bat for them, despite the insurance company's decisions. And, unfortunately, it didn't work in their best interest. They were left with a balance, and I think that's what initiated the claim, is that, we didn't do what we were supposed to do to submit the claim appropriately so that they wouldn't be left with a bill. I wish medicine worked like that, but unfortunately it doesn't. So I appreciate the board's time listening. If you have questions, or I have the person that does the billing here, we have done additional classes, like I think we have discussed at previous meetings. We continue to try to hire competent staff that has knowledge of billing and medical procedures and coding, and are constantly trying to modify the way that we do things so that we can stay in compliance and provide the best patient care in Northern Arizona, and that's our goal.
Thank you, Dr. Thank you, Dr. Rosales. I do have a question, and I'm sure it's probably your staff can answer this. There, the complainant brought up something about a delay of time and from when the Medicare billing went on to the to the secondary. So I just, if you can address that, that they said, well, that's why the claim didn't get paid, because you weren't, you know, didn't file timely. So if you could address that question, I'd appreciate it.
Hi, this is Kim Evans. I do the billing for Dr. Rosales' office. I had billed Medicare, well, DMERC, originally. We got the denial, so I rebilled them. I was not really cognizant of the fact that access needs to be billed within 60 days, whether the claim is processed correctly or billed or paid by the primary. So that was an error. I couldn't get it to them in a timely fashion because I was trying to get the primary pay this claim so the patient wouldn't have to.
The primary doesn't pay anyways. You can't submit the claim to the secondary, so it has to go to the primary insurer first before you submit the secondary claim. So I'm sorry.
Right, yes, that is understandable because, yes, when you're waiting for a denial, of course, things are going to be held up. But that's what I figured that was would be your response. And was this patient sent to collections, Ms. Evans?
I'm sorry?
Was this complainant sent to collections?
No, it was not in collections at that time. It was still a insurance balance. I did notify the patient and his wife the day that we got the explanation of benefits. They'd come into the office, and I went into the treatment room to tell them, okay, so the brace has been denied by Medicare. I think that we can beat this, but I might need your help, but I'm going to fight this. Right now, this is not your bill.
Okay. Do you have any questions?
We fought it.
Pardon me, I'm sorry. Did you have something else you'd like to say?
Yes, as a matter of fact, as far as the billing of the secondary goes, we were not contracted with access for DME. They would rather send people to Hanger.
Okay.
We're fully expecting Medicare to pay for this.
Right. Okay. And I know I see that, you know, Dr. Rosales, when he sent the, you know, back on the denial and indicated, you know, that the patient's weight, you know, he had lost weight from the lymphedema and that, of course, that the bracing didn't fit anymore, and that certainly would indicate a new reason for bracing, but then that was even denied too, so... Mr. Rhodes, do you have
any
questions?
That's correct. And we asked for redetermination from Medicare, and they continue to deny the claim.
Yes, thank you. I'm going to have my board members ask questions if they have any now. Mr. Rhodes?
I have no questions.
Thank you. Dr. Yolano or Dr. Foreman, do you have any questions for Dr. Rosales and Ms. Evans?
No.
Okay, thank you. You know, we had... The issue, I agree with Dr. Polakoff's, about the charges and the insurance. That it was all, you know, you did, you know, there's no indication that anything was not done correctly with the ABN forms, et cetera, and you tried to help the patient in getting things paid. But I do see, again, I have even, you know, you've given your explanations. There still is a little questioning on some of the billing and the documentation. And again, that goes back to that we had two previous cases with these similar issues. And I think it just is, you know, it shows again that how much, if your documentation was better, you could defend your codes that you selected a lot better. And so, like I said, that goes back to the order that we had previously issued to you, Dr. Rosales. And you know, we're already addressing in that order CME for coding and documentation and billing issues. So since we're already addressing this, it's just another alert to you that, you know, hey, this has been a continued problem. So that shows the importance of those CMEs for those previous concerns. So, I mean, to my board members, you know, the option here is if you felt that this previous order was going to be still directing at this same issue, that we can just maintain our current order with Dr. Rosales, as it's, like I said, it's going on the same issues again. Or, you know, if you feel it's necessary, we could ask for a modification of the order to increase CMEs, but that, oh, I'm sorry, that we can't, that's, nix that. That's not a possibility. So, in this instance, my recommendation would be just because, you know, this is another, it's a repeat of the same kind of issues that Dr. Rosales is already being addressed with through a previous order, that this should suffice. If I have any, if, does anybody else have any remarks or comments on my thoughts?
I agree with, this is Dr. Foreman, I agree with you, Dr. Campbell, and I think the previous order should cover this one, and I would like to make a motion to dismiss case 2015C.
Do I have a second?
Second.
Any discussion on this?
Second.
Thank you. Because we are telephonic, I'm going to, you know, take a voice vote. That way we don't have any rollover from hearing your vote. So, Mr. Rhodes?
Agree.
Dr. Yolano?
Aye.
Dr. Foreman?
Aye.
Dr. Campbell? Aye. Thank you very much. Okay. Yes, just a minute there. All right, now we will move back to our informal hearing. Mr. Crawford, have you made a decision?
Well, can you make sure that Dr. Houston is back on the
line? Oh, pardon me. Yes, in. I'm sorry. Thank you so much.
Hi, this is Heather Broaddus. Can I?
Yes, I'm here on the line.
Okay, thank you so much.
Okay. And Dr. Polakoff is present also. Okay. Thank you. Mr. Crawford, sir.
Okay, so it's my understanding for purposes of today, an informal hearing, the board's not going to allow me to question the board's consultant, Dr. Polakoff. I assume you're not going to allow me to question the complaining patient either. Is that correct?
That's correct.
That's correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Which I want to do, just for the record, but you're not going to allow it.
Nope.
So I do want to make some opening remarks on behalf of Dr. Houston.
Just a minute, Mr. Crawford. Let me see where we need to swear the doctor in.
Wait. I need to find out what's the procedure is going to be first, okay? So I would like to make some opening statements. I do want to be able to ask my client some questions, and I do want to be able to ask Dr. Fried some questions. They're not going to be lengthy, but I'm not going to proceed without being able to do those two things.
That's fine.
Okay.
Would you like to have the complainant or the licensee first?
I have to swear in the doctor first. And yes, she will be first.
Okay.
So I'd like to make some opening comments before she testifies. Is that okay?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes.
So whenever you get to that point.
Yes.
Thank you.
Hang on a second. Okay, let me get back to where we are here. Okay, so we've had our summary from the investigator. Dr. Houston, please raise your right hand. I'm going to place you under oath. Do you swear or affirm that the testimony that you are about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do swear.
Thank you, doctor. Okay, now it's time. At this point, Dr. Houston can make her brief opening statement as well as Mr. Crawford. Would you like to go first, Mr. Crawford? Would you like Dr. Houston?
Dr. Houston can make her brief opening remarks and then I can make mine.
Okay. Doctor, please proceed.
Okay, thank you. Good morning, and thank you for giving me this opportunity. I will briefly address the issues. First, I will comment on the patient's vascular studies. I have admitted that I documented the need to follow up on the study and that there is no subsequent documentation confirming I did so. I cannot recall these circumstances, but assure you it is out of character for me. DR had palpable pulses and the wound was progressing, and so I was not suspecting arterial disease. I don't believe my care would have changed had I reviewed the results, as they indicated mild to moderate disease and the patient was still improving. When the wound stopped improving, I did refer him to the vascular surgeon where he was found to have progressive disease, as in worse than when he initially saw me. Second, I will address the billing concerns. I have reviewed my notes and TMC's records to a greater extent and have found the documentation necessary to support my coding. My documentation indicates what was discussed at each visit, which often included new wounds, changes in medication, or a change in offloading as examples. At TMC, wound care is a team approach with nurse case managers. So some of the supporting documentation is actually found in the nursing notes, including the after visit summary, which I have included an example so you can see. And then lastly, I just want to ensure the board that while I believe I provided good quality care to this patient, I do take this matter seriously. As with all things, there's usually room for improvement. I have implemented procedures at the wound care center to improve my documentation, and I have attended additional webinars and CME on the subject of PAD and coding. So once again, thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Huston. Mr. Crawford.
Yeah, thank you. Briefly, to kind of summarize where we believe this case is and kind of the chronology of events, the patient was referred to Dr. Huston on June 14, 2019 for an offloading boot because the patient apparently was noncompliant with Ms. Keel's request that he wear a surgical shoe, and he showed up basically not wearing it, and she referred the patient to Dr. Huston because of this concern. Can we get him into some type of an offloading boot that will allow him to work and ambulate? Ms. Keel, not Dr. Huston, ordered the Doppler study on June 17, 2019. She was identified as the ordering provider, and then the patient's primary care physician was also listed there as a referring physician. So the report was never sent back to Dr. Huston. It was never routed to her, so to speak. More importantly, if you look at the report, this is a vascular surgeon. And at the end of the report, he does not recommend anything. He does not recommend an angiogram. He does not recommend an angioplasty. He does not raise any concerns whatsoever. He does not call Ms. Keel. He does not call the primary care physician. And he raises no concerns at all. If you look at the report for June 17, 2009, you'll see that there's kind of a box to the bottom right, which explains how they come to conclusions. And you'll see that it says the criteria are less than 50%, greater than 50%, greater than 75%, or total occlusion. So this falls within the category of greater than 50%, but less than 75%. So that means there could be a 51%, for example, occlusion. And it is the vascular surgeon's responsibility as the specialist to let people know if he believes some kind of treatment or intervention for those issues is warranted. And Dr. Lavore does not recommend anything. So to put it in context, would this have affected Dr. Houston's care? No, it would not have. The patient saw a vascular surgeon for a specific study, and then the vascular surgeon raises no concerns and no recommendations. And in fact, if you fast forward to the first time he actually sees her in his office in November, there was basically a discussion between him and the patient about all this. And he said very specifically, a non-vascular surgeon would not interpret this as being a problem related to healing. And so he's essentially acknowledging that this would not have affected the care. If you fast forward then after that, when he sees the patient, he does a Doppler, and it's actually worse. It's a near total occlusion is what his finding was. That's why he recommends an angiogram in November of 2019. So my point is, in the appropriate circumstance where he believes that an angiogram is appropriate, that's what he not only recommends, he takes the bull by the horns and he gets it done. By the way, the angiogram report showed a 90% occlusion of the posterior tibial artery, meaning this position, what happened here is, if you recall Dr. Houston's response, this patient improved in terms of the right heel wound for a certain period of time, and then it stopped improving. Then we get a surgery being performed. She does an MRI. There's no evidence of osteomyelitis. She makes a referral to Dr. Lavore. So what happened here, we believe, is that this patient's disease simply got worse, and that was the reason why the healing stopped improving. I understand the patient has a different perspective on that, but if you look at Dr. Houston's record, she does document very well the improvement that occurred over that period of time. So in terms of Dr. Houston's care, she comes on board on, I think it's June 18, 2019. Patients referred to her to prepare, or to basically recommendations about an offloading boot. She doesn't find any evidence of peripheral arterial disease. She finds palpable pulses. And after that point in time, she has, in fact, sees slow improvement of the right heel wound. The other wounds actually healed without problem, really. So when things turned, she orders an MRI, and there's no evidence of osteomyelitis, and then she refers the patient to Dr. Lavore. Dr. Lavore, in his records, basically acknowledges there has been a significant change here. There's a very weak Doppler, subtotal occlusion, which is not what he reported back in June. And if he did come to those conclusions, then quite frankly, he's the one to be blamed here for not making any recommendations and not saying anything to anybody. So we think he wasn't that concerned at that point. There were some other issues that Dr. Polakoff talked about last time and in her report. She questioned this issue about follow-up x-rays. Well, an original x-ray was done. It didn't show any bony prominences to suggest that that's the cause of this ulcer. So respectfully, there wasn't any indication to order follow-up x-rays. There was a comment about follow-up labs. There simply weren't indications to order follow-up labs. And then there was an issue about cultures. There was never any evidence of infection, ever. It's repeatedly documented by multiple doctors. So what happened here, one, Dr. Houston is honest and does not recall the circumstances, and she didn't document that she specifically looked at the report. But even if she had, it wouldn't have changed her care. What happened was it kind of got off the radar screen because the patient was improving and she didn't find any evidence clinically of disease, of PAD, and she found pulses. So, and even as late as September 26, 2019, if you look at the history and physical at the hospital, The DP and PT pulses were palpable. There was normal temperature to the right lower extremity. There just wasn't clinical evidence that that there was a problem with blood supply to the leg. In terms of the Billings issue, you know, I respect the fact that Dr. Polakoff has a real interest in Billings, and she knows the book code book probably inside and out. But that's not the normal podiatrist in terms of those that type of analysis. Dr. Houston spent a lot of time with this gentleman. Every visit, he did debridements every time. She did debridements every time. It's well documented in the records. And so the billing codes were justified. To a certain extent, she's being criticized for the billing codes because she didn't document that she looked at this report. But that's not a justification for saying that the billing codes are inappropriate. So she provided good care to this patient. She's already taken some steps to try and address any concerns that were raised. This is not a matter that warrants discipline at all. If you want to give her a letter of concern for documentation, maybe that would be one thing, but clearly no basis for any kind of discipline. So thank you.
Thank you. All right. We now have the complainant DB on the line. Is that correct, Heather?
DR.
DR. I'm so sorry.
Yes, I'm here.
Yes. Hello, sir. This is Dr. Campbell. We need you to refer to you by your initials. And I would ask that at this time you can give us your summary and please try to keep that within a 5-minute time frame. Thank you. So proceed, please.
I don't have anything prepared like I did the last time I spoke to the board. I do have a couple of issues with Mr. Crawford's summary. Yes, I was referred to Dr. Houston by Kelly Keel, a family nurse practitioner, for a prescription for an offloading shoe. I think Dr. Houston would be the first to admit that the shoe was less than adequate, but that's another issue that I'm not really interested in contesting. It was Ms. Keel who ordered the initial Doppler study before I became a patient of Dr. Houston back in June of 2019. And I was unaware, as Mr. Crawford pointed out, that that study was reviewed in June of 2019 by Dr. Labor. I still question whether that's an actual fact, but if there is documentation, then I need to accept that. When I was referred to Dr. Labor in November of 2019, during my initial appointment, he used a handheld Doppler to test various pulses and blood pressures and so forth in my ankles and feet. And I said, well, doctor, you do know that there was a study done here back in June. And he looked it up in the computer, and it appeared at that time that was the first time he had ever laid eyes on that particular study. And in actual fact, that was the first time that I ever laid eyes on that particular study. And if I had been made aware of it back in June of 2019, I would have taken the appropriate actions to contact a cardiologist, as Dr. Labor recommended, which I eventually did. Dr. Houston, she did debridements along the way. She did the surgery in September of 2019. I believe it was September 26th, if memory serves me. And while the wound was well on its way to being healed prior to that surgery, it was at least twice as big and twice as deep after that surgery, which was something that I did not anticipate. He used a couple of devices to try and vacuum the wound closed those didn't work, and we kept going on and going on, and finally it was the nurse that was part of the team at Tucson Medical Center that recommended that I see Dr. Lavore. And it took another 6 months, 7 months almost, before I was able to return to work because I was limited to getting around using a knee scooter. And trying to do real estate on a knee scooter is impossible, as one might imagine. So, you know, I just question her methods. I question her trying to obfuscate and avoid being blamed for something that she should have been a part of. She should have reviewed all medical records when accepting me as a patient. And it's obvious that she did not, and I think it was obvious the last time when the board initially heard this case that it was clear that she was unaware of this vascular study from June of 2019 up until the point that I made my initial complaint to the board. So I have some clear concerns. I know Dr. Prolikoff has some concerns in that regard. Also, she, you know, she has concerns regarding billing. I mentioned to Dr. Prolikoff during our discussion that perhaps all the bills to Medicare were inappropriate simply because nothing was advancing. I never healed 5 months. I basically wasted my time under Dr. Houston's care for 5 months. So those are my concerns, and whatever the board decides to do, that's up to them. They're medical professionals and can evaluate the evidence and the situation in that regard. I just have those concerns. The initial questions that Mr. Crawford had for Dr. Prolikoff sounded, you know, I spent a lot of time in courtrooms, both as a news reporter and as an employee of Pima County Superior Court, and he sounded like a defense attorney trying to set the stage for a jury, which is the board in this case, to have questions about the competency of the investigating the investigator for the board. So while I admire his initiative in trying to do that, and the board put an end to that after their executive session, I still think that there is some concern that should be expressed by the board and perhaps some action that should be taken by the board in regard to discipline. And I thank you for your time and your indulgence in my concerns.
Thank you, sir. Do any of my board members have questions for this gentleman? Seeing there's no questions, we'll move on.
No.
Oh, pardon me. Did you, Dr. Foreman, was that you?
Yeah, I have no questions.
Okay. Dr. Yolano?
No questions.
Thank you. All right. So, we'll proceed on. Now, you've all read Dr. Freed's letter that was letter that was presented. So this time, I'm going to just ask Dr. Freed just to give us a 5-minute summary of his opinion, and then we will be able to ask board members will be able to ask questions of Dr. Freed.
Thank you guys for having me. I appreciate it. So when Mr. Crawford asked me to review the case, after I read it, I looked at everything that was done and I reviewed all the documents. And really, I don't think there was anything done that I probably wouldn't have done myself. You know, if you look at it in the giant context of the entire case and not isolate things out, Dr. Houston works in a wound care center. She works with these people all the time. She's got a team. You know, when you see a non-healing wound that's referred in, you have certain boxes that you need to check off. You look at things for circulation, infection, et cetera, et cetera. And she had already been seeing somebody else in the wound care center. She gets referred to her for an off-waiting shoe. And then that person had ordered an arterial Doppler. Now, let's be clear. An arterial Doppler is a very complicated test. Yes, we can look at pressures in the toe that are listed there. And a DPM can see whether it's biphasic or triphasic. But it's a very complicated test. And if you look at percentages, and I don't want to bore anybody with details, because I thought, well, do I really know what an arterial Doppler is? You know, an arterial Doppler looks at the speed at which the fluid runs through an artery. And based on giant volumes of patients, they came up with estimations of occlusion. And most radiologists don't want to read this. This is why it was referred to a vascular surgeon. The vascular surgeon read it. And when a vascular surgeon reads something like this, they make a decision whether further advancing in diagnostic studies, meaning an angiogram, needs to be done or not. I don't think, and one of the reasons I got involved in this case is I don't want DPMs to be responsible for trumping an arterial or a vascular surgeon looking at arterial Dopplers, just like I don't want to be trumped and be responsible for looking at MUGAs, EKGs, or stress tests, or chest x-rays. And, you know, to say that we need to look at all the records, we look at the records, but like I just had a very complicated patient. And, you know, wound healing is hard. It's a very, very hard thing to do. And these are really complicated patients. Now, this guy didn't have diabetes, so you wouldn't expect him to have distal calcification, but he still could if it was genetic. So you can pretty much count on his pressures in the toe, which were 0.7, which are consistent with healing. So I don't think Dr. Lavore made a mistake in not recommending an angiogram, but he might have. I don't know because I'm not considered myself trained, but based on the simple numbers, no intervention was required. For instance, if you go to a cardiologist and you have a 70% occlusion of a artery, you can then get a stent. At 69%, you can't, but that's based off of a dye study, an angiogram. And they have very specific data. We don't have that in the lower extremity. So we don't have no right to trump. So if she looked at it, what was she going to do with that information? She looked at the chart. She knew that she saw, or he saw, vascular. In my mind and in my practice, it's just like if someone had seen a pulmonologist or a cardiologist, it's taken care of. I don't have to worry about that part. That's compartmentalized. I got enough to worry about. So I don't think she did anything wrong. And, you know, as far as the coding is concerned, and also, you can flip it around the other way. Do you know how many times I send patients to vascular surgeons? They don't look at anything I order. They don't look at the wounds. This guy didn't look at the wound. It says wound undressed right on there. I mean, this goes on all the time. You stick to your lane. So this is not unusual. And if we start holding people to this standard, I think we're going to get ourselves into a big mess. And then, you know, as far as billing is concerned, if this was a workman's comp patient, you would bill a 99213 and a 11042. And, you know, you just bill. I know that there's certain things and you get, and our computers tend, you know, with the new EMR, things get repopulated and mistakes are always made. And I can't even tell you, if I were to look at my notes, each patient I see has like 6 pages of notes, but there's only 2 lines in there that actually make a difference. I mean, I can't even tell what my notes say half the time because it's just voluminous things of information because the system has created that. But the reality is when you review a chart, you can't review every documentation piece of information that's in that chart. You review what's relevant to the care you're going to give at the time. I don't look at every endocrinology note and every renal note and every single. I mean, I just saw a patient the other day. It's a transplant patient. I mean, I look at what's relevant, and I considered that a chart review. I mean, I went through and I spent an hour. I probably got through a fifth of his notes at most. So you know, when I look at this whole case and I look at the spectrum of what occurred and the environment that it occurred, not only do I think everything was appropriate, I think it was done well. So I just don't see anything here that is egregious or unusual or not within the standard of what everyone else is doing in the community.
Thank you, Dr. Freed. Mr. Rhodes, any questions for
Dr.
Freed?
Yes, I do. I was going to ask, would heavy smoking delay wound healing in a patient? Does it?
Wait, ask me the question again.
Would heavy smoking, I consider 1.5 packs a day heavy smoking, would that delay wound heal care?
Absolutely.
Okay.
So that's what I'm saying. These patients are hard to get better. But you won't be able to judge. So if somebody's a heavy smoker and they have, great question. I'm going to use myself as an example. I had heart problems, but I didn't know it. And I went through all these tests. I had stress test, EKG, MUGA, everything, echo. Everything was perfectly normal. My uncle happens to be a cardiologist, and he forced me to get a CT angiogram, and I had a 99% occlusion of my widowmaker, but all my tests were normal because he looked at it clinically. This situation, no DPM is going to be able to look at that arterial Doppler and come to that conclusion. That's a vascular surgeon's conclusion because you're not going to get the distal disease that you would expect to get in a diabetic. Smokers are going to get more proximal disease. So I just don't think that we should be responsible for that. And I think it's a bad precedent to set.
Anything else, Mr. Dr. Yolano or Dr. Foreman, do you have any questions for Dr. Freed? Gentlemen?
No, I don't.
Thank you, Dr. Foreman. Dr. Yolano?
No, I don't at this point.
Thank you. Dr. Freed, I appreciate your evaluation. And yes, one of the concerns that was addressed, I had questioned, the fact that I saw that there were calcifications on the x-ray and just the overall general picture of the patient as far as, other evidence of decreased vascular. So I think I was, and that would go back more to the observation of the patient maybe and documentation. So, and I agree. I mean, the vascular, a podiatrist does not supersede a vascular surgeon, obviously. But I think the big issue was knowing that this test had been done and not sought after in a more timely fashion. So, like I said, I think I appreciate.
Can I comment on that? Not to be disrespectful, please.
Sure.
So in a perfect world, I totally agree with that. We would want to look at everything, but sometimes, when you just see that they saw vascular, it's your box is checked off and and especially if your clinical exam, you have pulses and things like that and it's not high on your radar. If she ordered the test, I think that would be different, but she didn't order it. She might not have ordered it. I get a lot of patients that come to me from a primary care doctor with an MRI and I don't need an MRI, but I don't look at the MRI. It wasn't on my radar. It wasn't, part of what I was looking at. So I said, if you take it out of context, if you said, should your doctor look at every test, in a perfect world, that's yes. But in reality, I just don't see anything that was done bad or wrong here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, the evidence of, a quick progression of peripheral vascular disease over that certain time, like you just said about, and we understand that you have all our tests and everything looks great, but then you have a CTA in there, you see.
Exactly.
So, it's a whole total picture. I understand that. But I'll go back to the fact that I think we were most concerned with the fact that the test was done, but it wasn't looked at. So in my estimation in this case, and I would like comments from my fellow board members, I don't think that, it's an egregious situation. The doctor obviously has admitted that she should have, had looked for this. And I know she's already performed some continuing education, I believe, on PAD. And there was one other CME that she had taken. I would make a motion to file a letter of concern to Dr. Huston regarding the issue of not following up in what the board feels was a timely fashion on that vascular test to have an overall picture of the patient. And I would like, if we, the doctor has already done CMEs, but these were not board approved. So if we were going to add any kind of CMA to this, we would have to select, those would have to be approved. I believe we might also have the option of, if we looked at the courses that she's already done, can we post approve those?
Absolutely.
Okay, so that's an option that we have here also. So I will go back to my motion and say I would make a motion to file a letter of concern regarding the not following up what we felt was a timely fashion on the vascular test, and that the CME, board-approved CME, in the issues of, let me pull, Mr. Crawford, could, as a point of information, can you tell me what courses? There was a PAD course, and what was the other course that the doctor took?
It's at the back of that November 5. I can hand it to you if you'd like to see it.
Yeah, that will
be. You would understand it. And I will tell you that Dr. Huston had great difficulty finding courses that as close as she could. So this is.
They are, yeah, with everything having to be online, it is very difficult to get these. So, okay. Board members, she took a DSA priority amputation for CLI, recommendations from the CLI Global Society, and but these are, and it were, these are, should be all qualified through the CPME if she found them online. So, and then the other was an e-learning, pitfalls in the diagnosis and management of PAD. I'm just looking here to see, that one is for 1 hour, and the previous one, what's the hours on that one? I'm trying to see if I see it on here. Because it gives what you've, and you all read that in your packet, you can see what the different topics for this CME were.
You could ask Dr.
So, yeah, Dr. Huston, how many hours, ma'am, was your, that, the Global Society CME, how many was that?
That was 1 hour.
Just one. Okay, so you've had then 2 hours. So board members, as part of our discussion, that's 2 hours. And I don't know if you feel that's appropriate or if we should, we can move to accept these, but we can require in, if you'd like to see more hours, what is your opinion?
This is Dr. Foreman. I think 2 hours is adequate. That's my opinion.
Dr. Ilano?
I'd like to see a few more hours.
Okay. What would topic, if she can find more on the same topics, or should we be, do you want something maybe more in regard to, overall medical picture of patients with PVD? Or do you, is there something, would you like to see more of another category?
I'd like to see about a total of 5 hours, just all-inclusive about PAD.
Okay, so then she would need, then we would be requesting an additional 3 hours. So, okay. Dr. Foreman, how do you feel about that?
That's fine.
Okay. Mr. Rhodes, any comments? Or?
That would be fine if they can find them.
Yes, that's right. And, we give plenty of time for doctors to do that. So
I apologize, Madam Chair. Would you like to offer that non-disciplinary?
Yeah. Oh, yes. This is non-disciplinary.
Would you like to offer it as a consent agreement first to see if the licensee would be willing to enter into that consent agreement other than ordering it? You can do it either way. But since you have them here, you can always ask if you'd be willing to enter into a consent agreement for those 3 hours.
So Mr. Crawford, would you and your client be willing to enter into a consent agreement for non-disciplinary additional 3 CMEs?
Yeah, I don't think we've even discussed that, but you have the right to order that. You can just...
We can order
it. We can order a letter of concern and
some non-disciplinary continuing education.
Okay, yes. So let's proceed with that. So again, we'll, because I don't think the motion was ever seconded, so... my motion will read, we will file offering a letter of concern to Dr. Huston regarding following up in a timely fashion on the results of a vascular test and offering non-disciplinary CMEs. She's already completed two, which I believe the board has agreed that those two that she's already completed, we would approve, and so that would give her an additional, we had 3 more hours that would need to be completed. Again, these are above and beyond normal CMEs for licensure, and that must be their board, they need to be board approved and completed within 6 months of the date of the order.
Second.
Thank you. Any other discussion on this matter? We'll take a voice vote, please. Mr. Rhodes.
Aye.
Dr. Yolano.
Aye.
Dr. Foreman.
Aye.
Dr. Campbell, aye. And that concludes it. So you'll be sending the order to Mr. Crawford.
I'll draft it today and...
Yes, sir. Thank you, gentlemen, for your time. I appreciate it. Sorry with the delays and things. Thank you, Dr. Huston. Okay.
Thank you, board.
All righty. Okay.
Madam Chair, if I may.
Yes, ma'am.
I believe that Dr. Steck has joined.
Oh, good. Dr. Steck, hello. Dr. Steck, are you present?
I got correspondence from him letting me know that he'd be calling in.
Oh, okay.
So I would think that he would be.
Okay, well, we can get ready here for Dr. We have Dr. Allison Rotman on the line, as well as her counsel, Elizabeth Peterson. Is that correct?
Yes.
Ladies? Okay. We're just waiting for Dr. Steck. He's calling in. This is for number 2 on our files, 20-16-C, Allison Rotman, DPM. We have, again, like I said, our investigator is Dr. Steck. Is Dr. Steck there? I don't know. There are gremlins in the phone.
They are. They're hiding.
Just please bear with us here. We'll just kind of give Dr. Steck a few minutes. People can just kind of take a deep breath here.
I apologize. I got the correspondence at 10:28, so it's only been a few minutes.
Okay. We don't have anything else we can really do here. Somebody's fiddling.
You didn't eat breakfast. That's a mistake.
You didn't eat your breakfast. Oh, Weedy?
I didn't eat breakfast this morning.
Mm-mm.
You just ran out the door.
Ready, Mr. Rhodes?
Yeah, I love this.
Ready. Right. Dr. Foreman, Dr. Ilana, you ready to go back on record?
Yes.
Thank you.
Dr. Ilana.
Hi there. Dr. Steck, are you there, sir?
I am.
Thank you. And we have Dr. Rotman's on the line still with her counsel, Elizabeth Peterson. So we will proceed now with complaint number 20-16-C, Dr. Allison Rotman. And Dr. Steck, again, is our investigator. And so I would ask Dr. Steck for his report, please.
Okay. This complaint is filed by the patient alleging that she's been discriminated against by Dr. Rotman. The complainant feels that she was discriminated against because of her ethnicity, being African-American, being a retired senior citizen, and that her last name is Bush. Because of the above, the patient feels the doctor allowed her toe to become infected. In the information that I was sent, there was also a letter that the patient sent to the California Medical Board back in 2014, which alleges wrongdoing in California. The allegations here are discrimination resulting in allowing deliberate infection of her toe. Dr. Rotman provided to the board a 4-page letter outlining her care of the patient and absolutely denying any discrimination towards the patient. The patient was initially seen in May of this year, and at that time the patient didn't have any sign of infection. Dr. Rotman states she did follow up and reviewed urgent care records, noting that approximately 1 month after she saw the patient, so in approximately June of this year, the patient presented to the Banner Urgent Care, and the patient had a nail that had apparently been traumatically partially avulsed. At that time, she relates those records showed no gross infection, and a topical antibiotic were given. The medical records review, in my opinion, were very complete, showing an adequate intake and diagnoses and a plan of care, including proper diabetic education and diagnosis, tinea unguem. Nails were debrided with no signs of infection noted, and a bunion, which was asymptomatic, and no formal treatment was recommended. I did not speak with the complainant. She did not furnish an email or a phone number. In summary, I see no evidence of discrimination in this case. The patient really gave no specific instances of why she felt there was discrimination, other than there was no instances of how she was discriminated against, in my opinion. The letter written to the medical board, also in my opinion, is irrelevant, I did not review that in detail. Dr. Rotman, I guess she did review medical records of the patient from an urgent care, and maybe in the system that she's in, and I suspect this was in follow-up after this complaint was filed, and I guess my only concern is that looking at these records on somebody you're not actively seeing may not have been proper, and should be obtained by proper protocols, but the alleged statute violation was discrimination resulting in allowing deliberate infection of the toe, which I find is unsubstantiated. As previously mentioned, there's no direct allegation of discrimination, example, or instance cited by the complainant of discrimination, and I do not see any sign of discrimination in this case review.
Thank you. Dr. Steck, do any board members have any questions for Dr. Steck?
No.
Okay. Dr. Rotman, or gentlemen, were you about to say something, Dr. Ilana or Dr. Foreman? Okay. Pardon me?
No, I didn't understand the question. I'm sorry.
Okay. Dr. Rotman, or Dr. Rotman there? Would you like to make any remarks, ma'am?
I have a prepared statement, if that's okay.
Yes, please.
Okay. So, good morning, Madam Chairman and members of the board. Thank you so much for allowing me to attend telephonically to address you all. Given the current rising COVID cases, currently the recommendation is to dismiss the complaint against me. The complainant alleged that I discriminated against her on the basis of ethnicity, specifically because she is African-American, is a retired senior citizen, and on the basis of her last name. She offered no examples of how I discriminated against her. My interaction with the patient was limited to two separate office visits. The patient claims that I allowed the patient's toe to become infected after our last visit. However, I caused no harm, and when the patient presented to urgent care 1 month later, 1 month after our last visit, the patient's toenail was not infected, but rather the patient's toenail had ripped off as the patient pulled off a sock. As a matter of background, I received my Doctor of Podiatric Medicine from William M. Scholl College at Roswell Franklin University in 2013. I completed my residency at Level Federal Health Care Center in Mount Sinai Hospital in Chicago, Illinois in 2016. After working in Illinois for 2 years, I joined Banner University Medical Center in July of 2018 as an assistant professor. I'm board certified by the American College of Pediatric Medicine and board qualified by the American College of Foot and Ankle Surgeons for foot surgery and reconstructive wrist and ankle surgery. My licensure certifications and qualifications are current and in good standing. I have been a guest lecturer in the podiatry field, and I have an extensive resume of course participation within podiatry. Among the many facets of guidance, the Hippocratic Oath states that a physician's care for the patient should not be altered by any form of discrimination. First and foremost, I'm a physician, and I rigidly uphold the highest of ethical standards. I did not discriminate against the patient. I have never discriminated against anyone on the basis of ethnicity, age, race, or last name. I absolutely and categorically deny ever discriminating against the patient who filed a complaint against me. First, I do not discriminate against any race or ethnicity. My patients are predominantly older, and I would never discriminate against anyone on the basis of age. Finally, I would not discriminate against anyone based upon their last name. The physician investigator who reviewed this matter agrees that there was no evidence of discrimination. He did raise a concern regarding my review of medical records of the patient from an urgent care after this complaint was filed. I understand completely that I am not to obtain follow-up records on patients if they have terminated care with me. The review of these records was in conjunction with my attorney retained by Banner on my behalf. My understanding is that these records were properly obtained through appropriate legal channels, which my attorney will address with the board separately. As a conscientious health care provider with expertise in the area of podiatry, I respectfully request that you dismiss complaints against me. Thank you again for allowing me to address you today.
Thank you, Dr. Rotman. Do any of my board members have any questions for Dr. Rotman? All right. Mm-hmm. Well, I agree with Dr. Steck's evaluation, and that complaint is unsubstantiated. There's obviously no examples of discrimination given, and actually we have no purview over anything regarding discrimination as far as this board goes. So I will make a motion to dismiss case number 20-16-C, seeing that there are no violations of state statutes.
Second.
Thank you, Mr. Rhodes. Any discussion?
Second.
Thank you. Any discussion? All in favor? I'll go voice. Dr. Milano.
Aye.
Dr. Foreman. Dr. Foreman. Dr. Foreman, your vote, please. Mr. Rhodes.
Aye.
Dr. Campbell, aye. Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Steck and Dr. Rotman and Ms. Peterson for your attendance. All righty. We have.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Our last investigation file is for complaint 20-17-C, which is for Dr. Seth Clark. I believe the complainant is also present telephonically, and initials for the TF and Ryan Shiver is also present with the complainant on telephonic. Dr. Clark, I believe, is telephonic. Of course, Mr. Crawford is present. And our investigator on this case is Dr. Saunders. Dr. Saunders present? Dr. Saunders?
I'm present, yes.
Hi. Okay, so Dr. Saunders, if you would please proceed with your investigator's report.
Yeah, okay, I will. I've actually, you know, it's a kind of a lengthy report, so I'll just kind of summarize. Everybody should have one in front of them. This was a rheumatoid patient that was referred from the rheumatoid nurse practitioner to the podiatrist working for the group for care of a increasing soft tissue mass to the ankle area. Patient ended up seeing the podiatrist and then was scheduled for surgery. And the patient shortly had a reconstructive surgery in addition to the removal of the mass. Subsequently then developed some wound complications that are still potentially part of the patient's ongoing problems going forward. Discussion was made with the patient, and the concerns were made for negligence following the postoperative wound care, and then there were some billing concerns as well. I did have there was some just written communication reviewing Dr. Clark's response. And the billing issue, I think, can be unsubstantiated and cleared up as the patient was concerned that was told that an Achilles tendon procedure and repair was performed, and that the patient thought that the doctor was billing inappropriately for that, when indeed a gastroc recession procedure was chosen and was billed appropriately. So I think that is very clear cut and unsubstantiated. The concerns for wound care, I'll discuss a little bit in detail here. I had some problem when I'm reviewing the charts and following the notes, understanding Dr. Clark's thought process and logic as to what was chosen and the steps of care going forward that maybe he can clear up for us as reviewing his response and some further communication after the report was made. Comments are just not necessarily documented, and I'm not sure how the thought process agreed, and I'll leave that for the board to communicate. There were some procedures that were performed preoperatively and postoperatively that had some contrary results, which is not necessarily uncommon, but the doctor does not address that or his actions therefore after as to why he differed clinically or his and overall opinion that I think would need to be addressed as it differed from the report that was done. For instance, there were two MRIs done and the doctor had different views of opinions as to what the results were than the reports were stated, and it's not documented in the chart as to his thought process regarding that. I'm not here judging whether it's appropriate or not. It's just it's not documented as for why he took those steps and measures going forward. Initially was seen for a soft tissue mass, and then in the initial physical examination, there's very little discussing the soft tissue mass identified. Focus was mostly on some ankle instability that may or may not have been present there. Patient was consented for a surgery, and in discussion with the patient, there's a difference of opinion as to which procedures were going to be performed regarding the reconstructive surgery. I think Dr. Clark had planned to do some reconstructive surgery, including an ankle arthroscopy, ankle stabilization, a gastroc recession, and then removal of the mass as well. And patient thought that the procedures were performed after the fact due to the severity of the soft tissue mass, further creating some more stability. So he said, she said, the consents were signed preoperatively, clearly indicating that that was Dr. Clark's opinion and procedures chosen, whether it was going to be performed initially as a thought or if the mass was causing some problems. Subsequently, the patient had the reconstructive procedure and initially developed some kind of some erythema, some complications initially started. Patient was put on multiple antibiotics throughout the course of recovery. There are some pictures that the patient did send that I did have reviewed, but there are no dates attached to them, so therefore I cannot verify what the wounds look like. Going through the post-op follow-up care, Dr. Clark's notes, there is, and he admits that the wound is on and off, but there's no notations of wounds in his charts. In the assessment, it says that they're there for wound care, and then there's no real wound descriptions going through the course of care. I think the first mention of a wound was when the patient went to the emergency room on 5/17, approximately 1 month after. And then in Dr. Clark's notes, there's a mention of a wound in 6/7 after the postoperative care. The patient was put on multiple antibiotics as the course goes by Dr. Clark, by an ER doctor. Subsequently, down the road, I think approximately at 2 months, the patient was admitted to the hospital after going to the emergency room for the second time. Following the care through the notes for the doctor, there is never ever really a mention of a wound, though he acknowledges that the patient has had some wound on and off. There is no wound care orders noted in the chart, so I'm not quite sure what the patient was putting on this dehiscence from the surgical wound, besides just giving an antibiotic. There is some notations of dressings being removed and some compliance issues in Dr. Clark's notes as well, though. There was no real plan of a care up until the fact that Dr. Clark, after two ER visits, sent the patient to a wound care center approximately 3 months later. There was an MRI done at 2 months later after a new subsequent trauma that occurred, where the doctor was ruling out maybe a fracture or a subsequent trauma. And there are some differences of opinions as to what their MRI results are there. Dr. Clark does not necessarily put in his notes that I saw a response to the MRI findings. He did respond to it in his communications with the board. And there was no action taken besides just walking in the cam walker boot following that. Patients subsequently did have a transition of care and saw another podiatrist. I don't have those notes typically available. The patient did have some surgical interventions, and she can tell you better than I can, but she has been having some ongoing complications still that may or may not be related to this postoperative infection. That's going to be my summary for you guys. I can answer any questions if I can.
Thank you, Dr. Saunders. Dr. Yolano or Dr. Foreman, do you have any questions for Dr. Saunders?
Yeah. Hi, Dr. Saunders. This is Dr. Yolano.
I'm here.
I believe there was a question on the timeline of the complaint.
I think, you know, this is dating back to 2017. The original surgery was 4/14/17. I think that when it first got to the board, it's been a while. I'm not exactly sure of the date that it addressed to the board. In discussing Dr. Clark's response, he feels that the matter is beyond the statute of limitations. I'm not an attorney. I can't comment.
Gentlemen, may I interject there? There is a statute, an overriding statute in the state. It's 32-3224, entitled Complaints, Time Limitation on Filing. Notwithstanding any time limitation to the contrary in this title, a health profession regulatory board may not act on its own motion or on any complaint received by the board in which the allegation of unprofessional conduct or any other violation of the chapter that applies to a professional who holds an Arizona license or certificate occurred more than 4 years before the complaint is received by the board. The time limitation does not apply to medical malpractice settlements or judgments or allegations of sexual misconduct or if such incident or occurrence involved a felony, diversion of a controlled substance, or impairment while practicing by the licensee or the certificate holder. And number two, board's consideration of specific unprofessional conduct related to a licensee or a certificate holder's failure to disclose conduct or a violation is required by law. So this is still within
our purview here at the board. Does that explain it?
Yes.
Okay. So, Dr. Foreman, did you have any questions for Dr. Saunders?
Is the practice.
Dr. Foreman, you're just kind of splurting in and out there with your communication. It's still bad.
Okay. No questions right now.
Okay. Mr. Rhodes, any questions?
No questions.
All righty. So thank you, Dr. Saunders. Now we have the complainant is present, and we will give you, ma'am, 5 minutes here. Get your initials again so I don't. TF. So, ma'am, if you could give a summary of your statement and try to maintain that to 5 minutes, please. Hello?
Hello. This is TF, and I apologize. My call got dropped just as you began to talk about the case.
So, ma'am, if you can give your summary, and like I said, could you please keep it at around 5 minutes? I'd appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you for allowing me to have an opportunity to speak. I had seen Dr. Clark for a small, what appeared to be a small cyst on my foot. The surgery was discussed. I did not sign consent forms for surgery until I was at the hospital the morning of the surgery. Now, prior to our discussions, and I take responsibility, I signed these forms based on the discussions I had with Dr. Clark. I would like to indicate, however, that after the MRI, Dr. Clark insisted that it is a mass and they can't determine if it's cancerous or not, and some surgery needed to be done right away. I informed Dr. Clark that in 2 weeks post-surgery, I needed to be in New York for my son's college graduation. His response was, that's not a problem. You'll be in a camp. You'll be okay to travel. As you can see by the records, I had substantial drainage issues that were constantly drained. Dr. Clark continued to tell my wife and I that was normal. On the third follow-up visit, I believe it was, my wife began asking for him to culture it for MRSA. His response was, this is normal. It's okay. Appointment just prior to the first ER visit, he put some paste on my foot and claimed that it has worked with other patients. However, that paste contained iodine, which is clearly documented in my records that I am allergic to iodine, so I sustained an allergic reaction and a surface burn. I was transferred to another Banner hospital where, again, I was admitted and treated with antibiotics. My wife asked again for it to be cultured for MRSA. He again indicated that it was not necessary. I came home from that and had a course of 28 days of vancomycin transfusions twice a day. At the end of that treatment, I still continued to be infected. So I went for a second opinion with Dr. Mark Campbell at the CORE Institute. It was determined that, yes, I was infected with MRSA, and the screw, it seemed to be the cause of the MRSA that was implanted. The head of the screw had broken off. At that point, I continued to be on oral antibiotics. I also then subsequently had a MRSA in my sinuses, which I was treated for. Then I developed a mass on my buttocks, and when that was removed, it was determined to be MRSA as well. After the MRSA infection surgery for my buttocks, I began having heart issues. Again, they did testing. I was placed in the hospital, and when I received a pacemaker, and at that time, they felt that the infection to my left ventricle caused my issues. They couldn't determine at that time whether it was 100% because of the MRSA, but they felt that because that is the only infection I had had prior to my heart issues, I didn't have a heart issues prior to any of this. They implanted the pacemaker. I've continued to have MRSA in my blood, in my sinuses. I've been on Zelli probably 9 times in the last 3 years. This summer, and this is the reason why I chose to bring my complaint to the board at this time, is that, again, I had another mass. I had another infection in the foot that required to have a portion of my foot removed and bone grafted, and that was infected with MRSA as well. And then I proceeded to have 9 weeks of 5-a-day transfusions of 3 of vancomycin and 2 as of aztreonam at home. And currently I'm going back for another follow-up because it's believed that the infection is still there. So I feel that Dr. Clark is negligent, and I was harmed in all this because at many points along the way, my wife asked him to culture the infection, and he continually told us that green is normal. So I thank you for your time, and I look forward to the board's decision.
Thank you, ma'am. My board members are I have some questions I would like to ask you. So, ma'am, did you, prior to you becoming a patient of Dr. Clark, did you ever have any MRSA infections prior from other surgeries or at any other time prior?
No, ma'am.
Okay. And were you compliant to Dr. Clark's post-operative instructions?
Yes, ma'am. The instructions that he had given my wife after the initial 2 weeks was, in fact, he gave us the medical supplies to rip and clean the wound and wrap it every 2 to 3 days, which he did. Mm-hmm. So we were compliant. I remained in the CAM booth until I transferred to the other doctor for a second opinion. He had me stay in the boot, and that's what I did. I did not go out of the boot until I transferred to the other doctor.
Okay. And can you tell me what of the other procedures that you've had done? You said you had a secondary surgery lately that removed part of your foot. Can you tell us what was done?
Yes. After Dr. Clark's surgery, Dr. Campbell performed a clean-out surgery and removed the screw. Then this past summer, it began getting red, and there was a considerable temperature change on the foot as opposed to the rest of my body. And then a mass developed, which when I had the surgery, that was cultured. And the bone was cultured, and it came back to be MRSA as well. They took out a portion of my bones in the side of my foot, which they also then did a bone graft. And I stayed in the hospital another 11 days. And then when I came home from the hospital is when I was on the 5-a-day transfusion for 9 weeks and hopefully clearing up.
Thank you.
Okay,
thank you. I have a few more questions, ma'am. Did you have ankle sprains? Have you had a history of ankle sprains prior?
No, ma'am.
No.
I did have a history of a plantar fascia partial tear approximately 3-4 years prior to this, which required no follow-up post-op care as far as therapy or anything, and I healed fine.
Okay. And you indicated you were wearing your CAM boot when you were in the airport? When you had
ma'am.
Okay. Are you a smoker, ma'am?
Yes, ma'am.
And how much do you smoke and for how many years?
Less than a pack, and I didn't begin smoking until after all this began. I want to say in September, October October of 2017. So there's something wrong.
Okay. And you're not okay. And you're not a diabetic, correct?
No, ma'am.
And do you suffer from Raynaud's disease with the cold exposure that you get the red, white, and blue of your digits, toes, nose?
No, it's a rheumatoid arthritis, so I do get the purple coloring in my hands. I do get pain in my joints, specifically in my hands and my neck.
Okay.
And my knees on occasion, but it's mostly my hands and my neck.
Okay. And I have another question. So during, you described the most recent surgeries on your foot, with the discoloration and the coolness of the extremity, did anybody indicate or discuss a possibility of what's called a chronic regional pain syndrome with you?
No, ma'am. It wasn't coolness of the foot. The foot itself had a higher temperature than the rest of my body by 2 degrees consistently for a week before the orthopedist and the mass developed and the orthopedist went ahead with surgery.
Okay. Thank you for clearing that up. I appreciate you answering my questions. Dr. Ulano or Dr. Foreman, do you have any questions for our complainant? Gentlemen?
No, I have no question.
Dr. Foreman?
Yes, did the wound get worse after you flew back to Dr.
I apologize, it's cutting out and I didn't hear your question.
Dr. Foreman, Dr. Campbell, I have a suggestion for a solution. Can you text your question to Heather? And that may help us here a little bit. I'll just give him a moment here to text his question.
Not a problem.
Thank you. Anything coming through yet? Okay. Give it just a few more minutes here because we've got a lot to go through.
Did anybody else have questions?
Mr. Rhodes, did you have questions?
I was just going to ask if she had diabetes, but you asked that. So.
Okay. Anything yet there, Heather? Okay. Well, we can
move. I sent it via email.
Oh, you sent it.
We can hear you now.
Now I can hear you. Yeah, so try to ask it now. Yeah.
Okay. Did the incision site worsen after your flight to New York and back?
No, it did not. It remained the same. Which prompted me to go to an emergency room in New York, Nyack Hospital, which it was determined that it was still infected, and they gave me oral antibiotics at that time. It didn't worsen, but it did not get better.
Okay, thank you.
All right, so it sounds like everybody's got their questions completed with our complainant. Dr. Clark, are you on the phone?
Yes, I am.
Thank you. So we have Mr. Crawford is also present here. So We can start with you, Dr. Clark, or...
Just a couple brief comments, Dr.
Okay,
Campbell.
Yes, okay. Well, Mr. Crawford has a couple comments first, and then we'll hear from you, Dr. Clark.
Sure. So Dr. Saunders raised a number of questions. That's why we did our letter dated October 19, 2020, to have Dr. Clark address those issues. So he's really here ready, I guess, to answer whatever additional questions you might have. But I would like to remind the board, in terms of the documentation issues, this was previously addressed by the board last year or beginning of this year. That was dealt with. It's the same time frame. It's the same issues with his DMR system, et cetera. So, and this board's position has always been they're not going to go back over and redo this again with a doctor or punish him because of issues that have already been dealt with. So I just want to remind you, this is, unfortunately, it's the same time frame. That's already been dealt with. You know, he's already voluntarily been through audits for something like 10 months or something. So he worked closely with Dr. Polakoff to get the documentation issues resolved and any billing issues resolved. So really, he's here to answer whatever additional questions you might have. You know, it's hard to defend some of this stuff when you talk about MRSA and stuff like that. We don't have any records, at least that we don't have. Maybe you have some more, but we don't have anything that documents the MRSA that says how it came about. You know, she was at the hospital for some emergency visits, and she was put on IV vancomycin by one of them. So I'm having trouble believing that a culture wasn't done at that time, but we don't have access to it. Dr. Clark actually did put her on the Levaquin before that, just so you know, because of the incident, I believe, in the airport, where he thought she had traumatized the leg. So, you know, we tried to address Dr. Saunders' concerns in the supplemental letter. And then the documentation stuff, you know, it's just, it's already been dealt with.
Right. And, you know, as board members, we're aware of that, but Dr. Saunders was not an investigator at that time, so he would not have been aware of that. But, so if you're completed there, Mr. Crawford, I'll ask Dr. Clark if he has a statement he'd like to make, and then we can ask questions of him. Dr. Clark?
You know, thanks to Dr. Saunders for doing an investigation and for you guys being able to hear this today. You know, I think I agree with Bruce that a lot of the confusion from just the charts like, arises from the poor EMR system that I had at the time. And we've extensively been through that with you guys before. I would like to, you know, just, I guess, say that the postoperative wound was very on and off. It was closed, it was open, and in the notes when I do document, I note that there was some serious drainage at the time, which, I don't routinely culture serous drainage because that's considered to be normal drainage. And so, you know, she was on a few rounds of antibiotics. It was rather extensive wound care, actually. You know, going back through the timeline after some ER visits, we even had her set up with home health care at one point to do some bandage changes. She was on, she was on a few different antibiotics to cover a very broad spectrum. And so I feel like the issue that the documentation is a little confusing, which, again, we've been over that in previous meetings together, and that issue has been corrected. And I feel that there was rather extensive wound treatment for this patient after surgery between there was, you know, again, various antibiotics that covered a lot of spec with, you know, home dressing for wound care, referral to the wound. The problem, I think, that I had the issue with the wound is it was so come and go that it was trying to decide when, you know, to send her to the wound care people because, once I was on the verge of sending her to wound care and then the wound was filled, so I was like, well, we don't need wound care anymore. And so, anyway, that's kind of my take on it. I appreciate the work you guys put into this, and then I'll kind of let him take over a little bit. Yeah, I do feel like they're
Thank you, Dr. Clark. I have a couple questions. Were you done? You were kind of cutting back, and I couldn't tell if we couldn't tell if you were completed in your statement. Okay, I do have some questions, though, Dr. Clark. Did the patient ever give you a history history of any previous MRSA infections?
No, I don't believe so.
Okay. And, of course, I know we've had, there's some question here regarding the patient's compliance. So I went back through, there were like two sets of records in our file that we were presented with. And I know you don't have it in front of you, but I will indicate that the dates and page numbers for my board members so they can see that on their computer screens. Because there's some conflicting information here now in regarding the patient's compliance. And board members, on page 802, the visit is 4/26 of 17, and it's indicating that the patient had been noncompliant to care, and it is signed by Dr. Clark at 11:10 a.m. Then on page 934, same date of service, 4/26/17, says the patient is being compliant. And the signature is there from Dr. Clark, but there is no time stamp. On page 806, for the date of service 5/3/17, again, the patient is noted to be noncompliant. Signed at 12:11 p.m. On page 936, date of service 5/13/17, says the patient's compliant. And there's no time stamp on the signature. Page 810, date of service 6/5/17, the patient's noted to be noncompliant. Signed at 2:09 p.m. Page 938, 6/5/17, patient's compliant. And no time stamp on the signature. I have a couple more, you know, it just followed this pattern. So it's like, okay, do we have two sets of notes here? You know, is this in relationship to the previous medical record system? So, Dr. Clark, can you explain why that appears that there are two separate notes, one having a time of signature and the other not, with a difference in a statement of patient compliance versus noncompliance? Because I honestly tell you, this brings a negative inference to me that there might, you know, not accusing, but saying you get this, there's a inference that could be drawn that this could be an attempt to alter medical records. And so I would really appreciate a explanation to this.
Okay, so I don't have, obviously, those page numbers or anything. I just know that when the complaint came in, when I was notified in August, I no longer worked for the arthritis company. And so records were requested. I don't know because they do all the records. So I don't know any of what's happening here, to be honest.
But that doesn't address the fact that in one set of notes, you're saying the patient is noncompliant to postoperative care. In the second note, on the same date, the second set of notes, it's saying the patient's compliant. Your signature is on there, but there's no date stamp. So this kind of...
That would be a question that I think would need to be addressed with Arizona Arthritis and their IT. I don't know how that record system works, or why that would, I don't know why that would have a timestamp on one and not the other.
Well, and I'm going back to the difference in what is said in the record. So I'm kind of, think, you know, if we're at the point here where we need to table this so we get some more information, or do we need to proceed to, you know, another level of, you know, investigation here?
Madam Chair, if you need more information, I would say that you would want to continue this matter in order to get that.
Yeah, because I think, yeah.
Before you move it forward.
Yes, ma'am.
If I may, Madam Chair, I just looked at the, you know, the hard copies that I have, and from what I can tell, Dr. Clark did submit the records. I did not have to send a subpoena to the organization that he referred to.
Well, like I said, in our file, we received, and I noted those pages. There are duplicate, like I said, and one thing says one thing, and one says another. And I did not, you know, that Dr. Clark is no longer there, but it just, this is a concern, and I don't, you know, I want to have an answer.
Excuse me, this is TF.
Ma'am, I'm sorry. No, at this time, you've had, you've made your statement, and we're in the process here, so please refrain.
But you mentioned, ma'am, there was no documentation of the MRSA,
and I wanted to know where the reports
from Dr. Campbell were that indicated that.
Excuse me, TF? This is the time for the board to address the licensee and then deliberate. Your time has already occurred, so we need you to keep it down and not interrupt the board. Thank you.
Okay, I apologize.
So, yeah, because that's another issue, is the not having any kind of, you know, results on any kind of infection. My board members, what are your thoughts here, gentlemen?
To me, this is concerning. I'd like to get more information on the two different sets of notes and why there are two different sets of notes.
Okay. Mr. Rhodes? Okay, so at this time, I am going to make a motion to continue the investigation regarding these issues that we've been discussing that we'd like more information on.
And that's more information regarding the post-operative notes?
The notes.
And
the two separate notes that I'm seeing, and any information about
the MRSA.
MRSA, yes, if there is evidence of positive cultures from the other facilities where the patient was treated.
Okay.
Do I have a second?
Second.
Thank you. Any other discussion on this? Seeing that there's no other discussion, we'll take a vote. Dr. Foreman.
Aye.
Dr. Yolano.
Aye.
Mr. Rhodes.
Aye.
Dr. Campbell. Aye. So this will be sent back to the investigator to get more information so that we can proceed with this at another board date. And if the complainant has any questions, she can forward that to our executive director. So for now, this, as I said, that we're moving this complaint to be continued. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Dr. Farrell on the line.
This is Heather Broaddus. Is Dr. Farrell still present on the teleconference call?
Let me go run and get him, okay?
Okay, thank you.
Hello, this is Dr. Farrell.
Hi, Dr. Farrell. It's Dr. Campbell. Just a minute here. I want to grab my thing. So, all right. Dr. Polakoff is
I'm right here.
The investigator, and she will give her update for case 18-0. 08-C, and it is the investigator's review of audit reports on updates. So please, Dr. Polakoff.
Thank you. This is patient DH, a 78-year-old diabetic male presenting to Dr. Farrell for terms of pain, difficulty in walking, numbness, and the doctor consulted the patient and determined that carpal tunnel syndrome affecting the sensory and motor components were present. He performed surgery on the limb on 6/20, and I did admire that he went to the patient's home for the post-op. The patient is 300-plus pounds, and it was very difficult for him to get around. The patient's progress was improving. He did have a little post-op wound care that was needed, and cultures were taken. The doctor, in his notes, appeared to have appropriate documentation, and the only concern I had was on the coding. The first visit of 5/11/20, it was billed as a 99204, and the E&M code does not qualify for a level 4, but it does qualify for a 3, which I suggest. And this was also carried through the 6/15/20 and the 7/8/20 visits, where both were charged a level 4 visit, which documentation does not support a level 4. Also, on 8/13/20, 28035, tarsal tunnel release, posterior tibial nerve decompression was billed, and 6/4/704, a modifier was needed for a neuroplasty of the foot. Otherwise, marked improvement, a little tweak of the billing, and I admire Dr. Farrell for the way he handled the post-op care for a patient who obviously would have trouble getting to his office and would eventually harm the foot by putting more pressure on it, trying to ambulate to the office from the car. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Polakoff. Does anyone have any questions for Dr. Polakoff? Okay. And I certainly agree there that Dr. Farrell has made improvements in his charting and documentation. And again, too, I agree that he did present great care and concern for his patient with all those house calls. So, Dr. Farrell, so you want to give a little summary of what's been going on and about the patient, if you have anything you'd like to add?
Well, on the modifiers, it was billed to the insurance company with the modifier. Somehow what we sent you was misplaced or something, because we did get paid for that with using the modifier. Still working on the coding. I'll get better at that too. I felt an initial visit with this large man, and all the work I had to do into it was, and he's a diabetic with hypertension, and I felt that was equivalent to a 204, but I'll have to redo my billing for this type of patient.
So
that's all.
Okay. Just a second here. Does anyone, Dr. Foreman or Dr. Ilana, do you have any questions for Dr. Farrell at this time?
No.
No.
Okay.
No.
Mr. Rose, I just have a couple questions, Dr. Farrell, and I can't remember if we've talked about it before, but when your patients at the Yuma Regional Medical Center, are they cleared from surgery by a PCP or the anesthesiologist?
Yes, the anesthesiologist.
Okay.
Okay, so now, okay. And because my other question was, because I didn't know if your hospital staff allowed DPMs to clear people for surgery or do the HMPs.
The hospital allows us to do the HMP, but it's secondary by the anesthesiologist.
Okay, thank you. Just, okay, so that led to my question, because on your pre-op visit where you're, you know, talking about, you know, the listening to the heart and the lungs and everything, and again, have a question as notice a breast exam on a male patient this time, and is there a medical concern in that exam that could possibly be related to the lower extremity complaint?
In an obese patient, gynecomastia, and even in a male, can produce tumors. And it's just a check, you know, so I can refer to the proper surgeon.
Yeah. And that, yes, that is, yeah, in an obese man, that certainly is a possibility. Because, and I know, you know, in the past we've talked about, you know, the performance of breast exams in female patients as part of the pre-op H&P. And, you know, having to find an association between that exam and what's going on in the lower extremity can at times raise the concern that maybe there's, practicing outside the scope of practice. So, and if there was ever a complaint that could rise from that, that would be a real challenge to defend that and deal with it. When you answered my questions regarding who's doing the surgical clearance and release, and that sounds like them. So when you're listening to someone's heart and lungs, that's not the total reliance of that the MD is actually is confirming those same kind of findings, and that theirs takes precedence over yours as far as, I mean, they're the ones that are actually clearing that patient for surgery. So, because again, the reason I had asked those is because, you know, with your malpractice carrier going to cover you for instances like that. So as how litigious is out there in the world, that just wanting to present and remind, you know, just again, using caution when you're performing those kind of exams and having obviously a reasoning behind the performance of those exams. But otherwise, like I said, really commend you for the care that you gave this patient. My goodness, house call work is hard, and that's to be commended. So board members have any other comments for Dr. Farrell? But we do appreciate. How are you? Are you getting more used to your Dragon system and all that with your computer?
Yeah, I'm using it every day, and I'm, getting better at it.
Okay. So we'll just continue, because this is the first case we've seen with you on your new system. So I believe we have two more is what we've. What we extended things to. So again, we appreciate your participation, Dr. Farrell, and the improvement is nice to see. So thank you very much, and we'll just wait until you have another nerve decompression case that you're completing and sending on to the board. So thank you very much, Dr. Farrell.
Thank you.
All righty.
Thanks.
Great. And just continue your, your communications with Heather through letting her know when you're doing those cases. So it's great. Thank you.
I will. Thank you.
Heather, I have a question for you. We were going to call the other doctor, right? But since we have our colleagues here,
Dr. Spickle should be on the phone at this point. Are you asking about the
and the other Dr. O'Brien's case?
Because I'm trying to determine. And I believe Dr. O'Brien is probably on the line as well.
Okay.
I am.
Okay.
Okay.
Hi, Dr. O'Brien. And may I ask is if Dr. Spickle is on the teleconference call?
Because we can complete those, and then we'll have plenty of time with discussion. Okay. So, board members, let's go back to... we have C, the issuance of licenses. We've already done Dr. Derner, so our other is Dr. Emily Spittle. Dr. Spittle has applied for licensure via comedy. Her application is complete and all statutory obligations are met. So does anybody have any concerns on the applicant? Okay. So I will make a motion to accept Dr. Spickle's application for licensure, and the license will be issued upon payment of said licensing fee.
Second.
Seconded.
Thank you. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? So moved. All right. Very good. All right. Our next here is we have... Dr. O'Brien is present telephonically. This is in regards to his complaint number 1714-C. This is on regards Dr. O'Brien's request to be released from his probation. If you've all had the opportunity to reread the original consent agreement, Dr. O'Brien was placed on a practice restriction. There, you can see the appendices that note non-surgical procedures that he was not to perform versus procedures that were allowed. Dr. O'Brien has the order was through November 15th of this year. Is that correct, Heather? So he has sent communication to the board asking that he be released from his probation status, and has indicated that he is not planning to go back to any kind of surgical practice, and that he is planning on just maintaining a non-surgical practice for the rest of his practice life. So we have some points that we need to consider in making our decision here regarding this. But first, well, these are considerations that we have, plus then, and after I go through those, then we will ask Dr. O'Brien to speak. If we release Dr. O'Brien from this probation, then the board itself gives up any oversight of this case, and there is no availability to this board to have a sworn affidavit or an attestation that says that would ensure the doctor's word in indicating that he would not perform any restricted surgical procedures as was on the consent agreement. We don't have to release him. He can stay on the probation status if we have concern of anything regarding the public safety. And again, if he is released and there are surgical procedures that are performed, that could result in the opening of a board complaint and possible pursuance of revocation of a license. So, with all those comments made, I will ask Dr. O'Brien to discuss with us his position, and if we have questions, we'd certainly ask him. So basically, I think it boils down to Dr. O'Brien. It comes down to trust. And so if you can please tell us why you think your word is trustworthy and for your release from your probation.
Sure. I appreciate you guys taking the time to listen to me.
I have fulfilled 100% of the consent agreement. I have not done any procedures in 3 years. With everything that's happened in the past, I don't want to. I'm 51 years old. I have no urge to go back and start doing surgery. I am very happy doing just non-surgical podiatry work. I have no aspirations to do any surgery in the future. It's been a lot less stressful, and I haven't had no complaints during the extent of this decree signed in 3 years ago in November. So I just think moving on from surgery is probably one of the best things I've done. I have no regrets about not ever doing surgery again. After listening to all the complaints this morning, it just reinforces my decision not to perform surgery.
Thank you. I have a question, Dr. Byrne. Are you having any issues with the probation status as far as your participation with insurance companies as a provider?
Yes, ma'am. And that's one of the big reasons I just would rather accept not being non-surgical and being off probation. It has affected some private insurances that have dropped me, and understandably so. But they said if I can get off probation, then I can get back on to the private insurers.
Okay. Thank you. Do any of my board members have questions for Dr. O'Brien? Dr. Yolano or Dr. Foreman?
No.
Thank you.
No, I have no questions for Dr. O'Brien. Okay.
No,
Mr. Rhodes?
I feel as though that Dr. O'Brien's completed all his civil everything penalties and is working with us, and I don't see any reason why we shouldn't release him from this agreement.
Would you like to make that motion, Mr. Rhodes?
I would make the motion.
Do I have a second on that motion to release Dr. O'Brien from his probation?
Second.
Thank you. Any discussion on that? All right. We will take a voice vote. So, Dr. Foreman, sir.
Aye.
Dr. Yolano.
Aye.
Mr. Rhodes.
Aye.
Dr. Campbell. Aye. It's moved and seconded and unanimously voted to release Dr. O'Brien from his probationary status. So, thank you, Dr. O'Brien, for completing your order promptly and in correct fashion, and good luck. And Heather will be sending you proper documentation. All right.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate it very much.
All right. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Take care. Bye.
All right, my colleagues out there, thank you for being patient. So we'll move on to D, which is the limited license podiatric radiological certification for medical assistants. And Heather will be our lead here on giving the background and going through this with you all. So,
yes, thank you, Madam Chair, board members. So I did provide a memo, so I'll try to be brief in my summary. But historically, the MRTB, the Medical Radiation Technologist Board, offered an exam specific to podiatric medical assistants in order for those assistants to become certified to perform x-rays. With that, Midwestern offered a six-week program specific to podiatric medical assistants in preparation for the radiology exam. The MRTB was recently disbanded within the last few years, and the Department of Health Services special licensing section now certifies individuals to perform x-rays and regulates radiology. And with that, DHS decided to no longer offer the exam specific to podiatric medical assistants. So the only exam currently offered by the Department of Health Services is designed for a medical assistant who went to and graduated from either a board-approved or an accredited educational program. So in doing my research on the different Arizona boards that have a definition and rules regarding medical assistants, I did provide what I found. So, and just a quick summary of those, and it's five different boards. So with the Arizona Medical Board and the Osteopathic Board, what I found was that they do not license or certify medical assistants, but that they do have a definition for the term medical assistant, and both of those boards' rules requires that medical assistants attend either a board-approved or an accredited education program. Neither of the boards I could not find in rule or statute where they address whether or not a medical assistant may perform an x-ray. The chiropractic board registers chiropractic assistants, but in their board rule, it says specifically that a chiropractic assistant shall not take an x-ray. The naturopathic board certifies medical assistants, and in their board rule, it says that a medical assistant shall not, unless authorized by law, perform an ionizing radiographic procedure. So that would be up for interpretation, what that means. The homeopathic board registers medical assistants, and their board rule states that a homeopathic physician must apply to the board to register a medical assistant. The homeopathic physician is required to submit to the board evidence that the medical assistant is proficient in specific duties. The medical assistant's duties must be approved by the board, and that board's rules do not address x-rays either. In looking further into the medical board and the osteopathic board, I did speak with staff at both of those, and it was confirmed that no one agency or board licenses or regulates medical assistants in Arizona. And it's basically up to the physician of those respective boards to ensure that those medical assistants have undergone education and training, you know, so they can perform whatever duties it is, whether it's x-rays, histories. And so it's really up to the medical doctor. And if a complaint were to arise, it would be on the medical doctor. So, of course, we have our participants from the Arizona Association here. So, hopefully, you know, they can give us some clarity on it as well. But my understanding is that if the board were to provide a definition of medical assistance in its statutes, it would not necessarily address the problem of the exam, because it's regulated by the Department of Health Services. And in order for them, the Department of Health Services, to offer another podiatric medical exam, it's not in this board's purview to demand that from that agency. And if the board did choose to insert a definition for medical assistant into its statutes, then at some point the board would need to clarify and rule specific requirements for those medical assistants, and the board could require a medical assistant to go through an accredited program, which may be 1 or 2 years, in order to be able to pass that exam that DHS now offers. That's, you know, something that the board can do. But just so the board is aware, Governor Ducey issued an executive order earlier this year that for every one rule the board wants to create, the board has to take away 5 rules. So that's something to think about as well. And that occlude, you know, that's pretty much my summary. If you have any questions, I can try to answer them for you. And then, you know, we have Dr. Mary Peters, Dr. Alan Discott, and the association lobbyist, Mr. Joe Boddy, here as well.
So, yeah. Do you have any questions for Heather?
I don't think so. I'd like to clarify that we're not asking about licensing for our medical assistants. We're requesting that because we are a specialized profession, that we can recognize specialized CMEs for our medical assistants, because we have very specific chores that they have to do that aren't standard for medical assistants. And those are nationwide courses that anybody can take. The AFAMA has prepared to offer those CME courses to our medical assistants as well.
And
So it's just a matter of recognizing CMEs in terms of us being able to oversee our medical assistants, as opposed to having them go through an entire different course that does not pertain to them.
We also have a local training course and certification course that's been in effect for, I believe, 18 years. Mm-hmm. It's taught by Margaret Hinckley. I don't have her credentials in front of me, but she's rewritten the course in the last 2 years prior to board consolidation and is completely able and willing to provide course interaction, education, and certification of completion of those courses, as she has for the last 18 years.
She's the lady that came and spoke mm-hmm. with it. So really, so if all there, if we're just asking that we cert, that we give certification like we would to any licensee asking to have CMEs accredited, that if we accredited the, if we accredit courses for them, is that under the umbrella of accreditation of CMEs for licensees, since they are under the direction? Is that making any?
It would be a revision of our statutes or the board statutes that physicians can then oversee their medical assistants who have that additional certification.
It's consistent with all the other specialties, allopathic, osteopathic, which we're more in line with than naturopathic and the chiropractic. But it is currently in their statutes, and it's just the ability to oversee our own staff in performing adjunct services for us directly under our supervision.
And board members, if I may, I did provide those statutes for the different boards.
So a statutory change, though, that would then be the responsibility of the state association to gain support from a legislator.
No, it would come from a, Madam Chairman, if I may, it would be part of any board bill. Obviously, the association would be involved in it, but it's a protection. It's an administrative thing. The thing we're trying to do here is simply allowing your board to administer a program by rule that, in cooperation with the profession, to legitimize somewhat of what you're doing and maybe bolstering the program. Right now, you're the only board that has medical assistance that has no statutory authority to do that. And this is, in my opinion, a protection for the profession and the board to put something in statute that allows some overseeing and administration by the board and with cooperation of the profession. It would bolster a medical assistance program, would bolster the quality of the medical assistant, that's for sure. It would probably allow them to be able to take the x-ray exams from the health department and better standing, wouldn't have some of the problems we have now, because quite frankly, you'll get better qualified medical assistants. That protects the patient, that protects the profession, and it is a legitimate function of your board to oversee that that regulation. And again, statutory authority, most of the four of the five boards, and I was involved, I might add, in the first getting the bill passed back in, I think, in 1989 or 88, in cooperation with some of the other boards that were mentioned. I did not represent the podiatry board at the time. I was representing the DO board and the homeopathic, I mean, the profession and the homeopathic profession. And so we all got this statute passed at the end of that session to alleviate a problem that the MDs and DOs had on physical therapy assistants, and to allow them to have their own assistants to be able to do certain things in their scope of practice that weren't around in that time. The medical assistants was a new concept then, and this would have put it in statute to allow their creation and protect each board. And by rule, each board would provide the standards and qualifications by statute. But again, statutory authority was a one sentence for four out of the five boards, just to allow you to administer a program by rule. And that's all these statutes did back in 1988 or 89.
So, and board members, if I may, so it, for my clarification, because I was under the assumption that, you know, this would help podiatric medical assistants be able to become certified to take x-rays, but for the board's information, inserting that, this is completely up to the board, you know, a definition for a medical assistant, we would still have to go through the rulemaking process. For CMEs, for any, you know, if the board determined that they wanted to do an accredited program, you know, required for medical assistance and outline, and I didn't provide all of the rules because some of them are very, you know, voluminous of all of the different boards, you know, and that would be up to the board if that's something that they wanted to pursue.
But if we make a new rule, then we're going to lose five.
Unless something changes within the next couple of years, yes.
You know, so...
Well, aren't there five outdated rules we can get rid of?
We've been doing that, Dr. Foreman. We've been going through things. Heather can tell you what, I mean, you know, what we've...
Well, and Dr. Foreman, Madam Chair, so we did just complete the rulemaking process, and in that rule package, we got rid of multiple different sections regarding, because the exam, the oral exam was repealed, you know, we cut back on the continuing education. So multiple sections were already removed. So, and again, it would just be up to the board as to whether or not they wanted to look at removing more sections. Inserting a definition into the statute at this point, you know, again, that's up to the board, but at some point the board would have to go through the rulemaking process.
I'm trying to ask a question, and the executive director, is it actually a rule that you're making, or you're just inserting that language into the current bill to allow oversight?
No, the definition for a medical assistant in statute would not apply to the rules. Statutes and rules are separate. And as far as I'm aware, there's no... limitation on how many statutes you can add or take away at this point, but with the current environment, you know, the environment is deregulation, not more regulation. So with that, the governor issued an executive order at the beginning of this last session saying that any board agency commission that wants to go through the rulemaking process for every rule that's inserted, which is separate from statute, you have to take away five rules. And the rules just clarify statutes, basically. So, again, if we insert in a definition, then if you look at the medical board's rules, the osteopathic board's rules, like I said, there's pages of, you know, the different areas that the medical assistant can practice in, what they can and cannot do, what programs are acceptable, what accreditation is acceptable, what the supervising physician has to do. So that's why I'm just letting the board know that it's, you know, up to the board if they want to insert a definition, but at some point we will have to go through the rulemaking process because the rule is what would give us the authority to...
Well, the statute will give you the authority to do this. The rule would make define the definition. You would not define a definition of medical assistant in the statute. All the statute would do, as you find in those four out of five statutes, is just giving the board the authority by rule to administer a program, and the rule would fill in the blanks, and that's it. So the beauty of a once... a statute of four of the five is that it's a one sentence. It would not affect your board bill in the sense of have a glaring thing. If you did it similar to of the language of the four of the five other they couldn't argue against you. Well, you're doing something really different. You're just following what other boards have done years ago. And you could also make the case, in my opinion, if you, a medical assistant program that after the statutory change would bolster the quality of your program and bolster medical assistance. In fact, you can make the argument that will increase the safety to the patients. Well, it's a win-win situation.
The argument I would make is that if we're going to follow Ducey's rule of reciprocity and the rest of the country has podiatric medical associations where their assistants are doing these things and they're recognized and there's a national American Society of Podiatric Medical Assistants, when another medical assistant moves from another state to Arizona, they're not allowed to follow through with the certification that they have obtained.
Right. That's another argument.
Mr. Bob, if you have the language for the rule or the statute change, could you get it together where we could add it in there?
Mr. Rhodes, yes. I've given to Heather this language that the five other boards that enacted the law were part of the bill back in the 80s. She has that language. Now, four out of the five just has a one-sentence clause, a statutory authority, to basically allow for, by rule, setting up of medical assistance qualifications, et cetera. It's one sentence. The MDs changed their law a few years later. Originally, they all had the same. The MDs changed it and put a specificity into the law about what the duties would be of the medical assistant. I wouldn't necessarily recommend that in the statute. You could do that by rule and give you more flexibility as a board working with the profession to put some meat on the bones, as it were. But that's your choice. Regardless of which way you want to go, if you decide to go that way, whether you want to have a long list of what they can and cannot do in statute, or just a one sentence saying, we'll fill in the blanks by rule after the fact, that's your decision. But either way, the arguments for doing something, I think, are pervasive, very persuasive.
Because all we have right now is a substantive policy statement, mm-hmm. you know, for what a medical assistant
can include. The board has reviewed this issue in an eloquent letter, a five-page letter from the board and Dr. Foreman to the Arizona Department of Health Services Radiology, addressing all of these issues specifically for radiology. And they've given everybody a deaf ear, whether it's from our medical association mm-hmm. and or from the board, in eliminating a program that had existed for I think some 18 years. I think this is what brought most of this to fruition.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's why we're coming to the board to understand the pathway for our physicians in this state to be able to provide the excellent level of health care to the public that we need to provide for them. You know, in limiting our services, further limiting our services more and more, it takes away from creating good health care for the public. It will increase the expenses for the public to go out and get radiology, pay for that separately, pay for separate radiology reads, come back to the office, delay care, et cetera, et cetera. I'm sure many people can understand that. So we are desirous of a pathway to allow us to monitor our assistants like all other medical professions do.
Should there be an issue with a medical assistant once we've done this, would that come under the jurisdiction of the board, Dan?
Yes.
Okay.
Physician. It would go back to the
physician would supervise.
Yeah, not to the, yes.
Which would go back to the board.
Right, it would
But the board would set up the rules to the programs, what their duties, fill in the blanks. But the physicians only would be responsible
if there was any complaints.
The physician mm-hmm. would be.
As we can currently perform other non-medically technical type procedures such as billing, note taking, scribing, entering medical records, doing your vitals and all those things, which are currently under our direction and our responsibility to the public and to our carriers and under our liability. I don't see that taking an x-ray would change the outlier of our responsibility as physicians and not the board. I believe currently they're allowed to transport patients from one portion of the clinic to another, position the patient in a proper place, and then the physician is actually taking the x-rays. This would allow the assistant under a educated course, CME, National Association of Podiatric Assistants, to provide better health care to our patients and support us as physicians.
And Madam Chair, board members, Dr. Discott, I did get a response from Florida regarding that, and from what I understand is that the Florida Podiatry Board, the State Association, and the National Association all have not a contract, but an understanding with the Department of Health Services. And from what I could tell, it sounded like there had to be major statutory changes with the board and the Department of Health Services in Florida in order to allow the Florida board to take on that responsibility for radiology. And so, again, it has to go back to the Department of Health Services as well, because that is the agency that regulates radiology in Arizona.
Madam Chairman, I don't believe we're trying to do away with the authority of the health board at all on x-rays. We realize these medical assistants, as Heather has pointed out before, still have to take the exam. Mm-hmm. And so we're not doing anything. We're not trying to get into piss and match with the radiology board. We're not limiting their authority at all. All we're doing is within the scope of our board, being able to provide the necessary training and rules that would bolster the quality of the medical assistance, and also giving you some statutory authority where now you don't. Quite frankly, it's not. Well, let's put it this way. It's a gray area, how much you can really regulate the medical assistants, because it's not in the statute. So what, again, the association is recommending is you just put something, a broad general authority to allow you to provide some sort of regulation of medical assistants by rule. You can determine after the fact about how much you want to put into the rules, your proposed rules, and work with the profession to come up with something that is meaningful. But from the politics of it, what we're proposing should not have a big problem. You have a board bill anyway. You would add a sentence or so, adding this to last year's bill as it goes through the process, have it introduced as such. And I can't believe that since all the other boards have this authority already, that they would be concerned about us having the same authority. And in fact, we can make the case that this improves patient care, and they should readily be in supportive of this among the other provisions you're proposing. So we certainly don't see a downside. If we thought this would hurt your bill politically, you know, we'd be very hesitant, I'm sure, about recommending this at this time. But the fact that you have a board already going through the process is the ideal time to put this in and get on with the process.
Our state association would be happy to help work in any way or form to help create after the fact, a program, definition, and work with our national society that whatever input we can provide when it's in more of a definition.
And Madam Chair, Ms. Board members, for what it's worth, I don't think that it would be an issue either putting mm-hmm. a definition in. You know, I do agree with with what Mr. Abadi is saying, I just want to give the board the entire picture, in that, you know, the board would have to go through the rulemaking process, what the requirements are now, and, you know, just leave it up to the board to decide.
Yeah.
Do we need a motion to add this?
It may be a little premature right now. I think the board needs to have more discussion on it.
Yeah, I would agree. And we need time to also peruse the rest of the rules again to see what is, you know, if we're going to end up having to give away, what could happen, you know, where that would come from.
And with
Mr. Ducey's.
And Madam Chair, board members, rules can be done at any time.
Right.
As long as, you know, we can meet those requirements.
Right.
You don't, Madam Chair, you don't have to come up with exact statutory language today. You know,
no.
But.
Because right now, too, because Ms. Brophy McGee is no longer, then we're going to end up probably, well, we've spoken before with Ms. Bartow, so.
And she'll be the Senate Health Chairman now.
And our next meeting is December 9th, and that would still give us time to add something before the bill is introduced
The
Senate. Mm-hmm.
So we can re-agendize this and get,
if the board wants more time.
Yeah. Dr. Yolano, Dr. Foreman, what are you guys thinking?
I'm thinking we have to do something, and I agree with Mr. Abadi's approach.
What do you feel like?
I'd like that one line approach to add more that we can add later. But I'd like to discuss this further amongst us and see, get more information.
And Dr. Yolano, Madam Chair, at the December board meeting, I can, make the, because I just included the statutes as they're written in those board statutes, I can bullet point them better so the board can choose language if that's what they choose to do. And then I can include some of the rules, too, that the other boards have.
Yeah. Yeah, that way it puts it in an easier format for us to work with.
Yeah, that would help.
So do you want to make a motion to put that on the December 9th agenda?
Yes, I will make
that,
a...
I guess we can wait until we get to that point of the agenda, because we're not there
yet. Yes, for new.
Sorry about that.
Okay. Anybody else have any other remarks that they want to make now? We have to put that in the next part of the meeting. That goes into a new agenda item. So, and I can make the motion there.
Madam Chairman?
Yes.
If I may, I would just, in all politeness, understand the urgency of this bill as January 2021 is coming very soon, and it's suppressing to the physicians in the community.
Sure, we had everything last year, and then with this dumbass part, with everything that happened, and then they weren't here in bills and stuff, and we haven't heard exactly what's going to be starting up. Do you know anything, Joe?
Well, Madam Chair, what do you mean by starting up?
Well, I mean, is the legislative session going to start? Is it going to?
Oh, yes, it will start on time, whether it be virtual completely or not is another question. It may be until you get a vaccine. You might have virtual hearings, and it's tough to lobby. You could talk on the phone. I know the most of the Democratic members are not having meetings in person to lobby, but some Republicans are. No one's announced whether the session is going to be as usual or virtual. My guess is, given the uptick of everything going on, that it'll certainly be virtual, because you're not going to really get a vaccine widespread until spring at the earliest. And so it'll probably necessitates a virtual type of session, which, we had for a few weeks in May or whatever, but when we stopped off in March, we had a hiatus of almost 2 months. So we're entering into new territory, but to answer your question, it's, we just don't know at this point. No one has announced. I don't know if they know or not, but so it's going to make it more difficult to lobby any bill. There's no doubt about it. But in this case, with our bill having gone through both committees of the House and just needed floor action in the House and then concurrence over in the Senate, most of these people have heard the arguments, and hopefully not any problems. We're not, I assume they're not going to put any provisions in the bill that caused problems before. And again, that was a surprise to all of us, but that they did cause problems. But saying all that, then, you know, hopefully it should go pretty smoothly.
And Madam Chair, board members, this kind of gets into what I was going to say in the executive director's report, but to just kind of expand on what Mr. Abadi said, I do have information regarding the board's bill, and I did speak with the Senate staff, and there has been a folder opened, and they are agreeing to update the fingerprint language that the board had agreed upon at its last meeting. But at this time, because Senator Brophy McGee was the sponsor and she was not reelected, we don't know who the sponsor is going to be yet. And I was just told that that they will let me, you know, contact me and let me know when the sponsor has been identified.
My recommendation would be Senator Bartow would be the ideal one because she's now the Senate Health Chair and she heard the bill over in the House when she was House Chair. So she's familiar and she's always been pretty supportive. So that would be my recommendation is have it start in the Senate like last time and have her introduce it as the health chair.
And the folder was opened in the Senate,
yeah.
What I understand.
Yeah.
So the Senate staff person that I've worked with, Cherie Stone, she's been very helpful. And if the board wanted to add this language in December, I don't think it would be an issue to get it inserted into the bill before it's introduced in the Senate.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Good deal. So I will make our motion when we get to the new agenda item. So
thank you.
Thanks for being patient.
Thank you.
It's been a long morning or day so far. It's getting long here. Okay. All right.
Joe left the stuff here.
Hmm?
I say Joe left his stuff here. I wonder if he remembers. Yeah.
All righty. Okay. So, guys, we're going to move on to E, which is the billing code changes. So I saw the article in the APMA newsletter anyway and forwarded on to Heather. But so these changes obviously will affect, you know, private practice and billing, but it also is going to affect us on how we adjudicate and evaluate complaints that come before the board. So as you know, if you've read the article, you can see, you know, they're going to be doing away with the 99201, that low-level initial office visit is going away. So, and they, you know, that article indicated that over time there certainly were going to be changes made. But again, like the biggest change is now they will eliminate the history and physical components, those bullet points that you had to reach to make certain levels of billing. So in determining a level code, and now they're going to base it on, you know, medical decision making, how many problems, how complex are the problems, how much data, complexity of data that has to be reviewed and analyzed in the decision making process, plus what is the risk to the patient. And, you know, what I think still needs to be important to us as board members and as people that are investigating, that it's still, you still have to have a well-documented and performed history and physical, because you've got, you have to have that obviously in order to to document the severity, complexity of problems that the patient is going to present with. And so, again, like I said, it'll change the way that we analyze these complaints with billing. You know, no longer can we say, well, you know, did you have to rely heavily on those bullet points, which we're not. So that may be a little bit of a learning curve here. And because, again, I'll go back to that, you still need the good history and physical, because if you don't, you know, that could still set a doctor up to, you know, if they're violating not having adequate records. So, and I know there's, they said more articles would be coming out from APMA, and, you know, you could maybe would behoove all of us to go on that APMA coding and review all these things that are going to be coming down, so that, you know, just for your own private practice sake, but again, as to being able to do our due diligence with complaints that have to do with billing. And of course, too, they're also adding, you know, they've that article delineated time elements too that are involved. So again, I think, you know, doctors are going to have to document those times in order, if they're going to prove that they met those level of codes. So that's my remark.
It was just the virtual coding seminar this weekend, actually, on it.
Oh,
and the APMA has a couple of good videos on their website if you want to go look at it. But pretty much it does, everything has to be documented with time, including putting the note, anything the medical assistant does not count in the time of the patient. It's only what the physician does, including reading the old charts. So it does have to be very well documented, according to Jeffrey Lehrman.
Okay. So you said that's a virtual on the APMA.org?
Yeah, it's APMA.org under practicing DPMs. Do you want me to just text it to you? I'll text you the URL.
Okay. Okay, cool. Yeah. Probably get good CMEs for that too. So anyway, but, and I, Heather shared that information with our investigators. I don't know if they're still on the line, but yeah, because, you know, now, you know, obviously as some of the complaints we've seen, you know, that's been one of our big, you know, things is, did you reach the level in your histories and physicals to meet the requirements? Well, with this going to be gone after, you know, starting January 1, you know, that's going to make a difference in things. And we're going to probably, I'm sure, people are going to balk and say, well, you did this to me last time. Well, yeah, but don't you, you know, realize now the rules have changed and we have to accommodate to the new rules, so.
There's going to be a lot more 99214s and 99215s, actually, if you meet the criteria. If you have a very bad diabetic wound, let's say, with Charcot, you podiatrists now can get the fives.
Oh, yeah, and that's exactly, and that's, but again, we're going to have to, you know, it'll still behoove us to be very diligent in our evaluation of that, you know, because, you know, what some one person probably thinks is super complex, another person might not. So there's, I'm sure that's going to bring on some very good discussion. Anyway, but yeah. So, you know, and I'm sure, you know, it's, you know, people have always felt that, you know, the time they spent with the patient is important, because it is, you know. But again, you know, it all just has to be, you know, as we've always said, talked about the documentation. So anyway. Anybody else have any comments on it? All righty. So Heather's given a portion of her executive director's report, but I'm sure she has a little bit more.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, board members. At its September meeting, the board issued Dr. Catherine Kennedy a non-disciplinary order for CE, and Dr. Kennedy has since completed that requirement, and she's been released from the order. I did submit a current budget update and can answer any questions if you have any. And board members that are here in person do have an updated complaint log. There was one additional complaint added, I believe, since I sent out board materials, and I can answer any questions on that as well. And that's my summary.
Okay. All righty. So next is our summary of current events. I can't remember if this is the place to put it, but I would offer my condolences to Heather in the passing of her grandma.
That just was recent, so. And call to the public. We don't, everybody's gone. We don't have a public to call to. So then number nine is our discussion, possible action for items of future meeting agenda items. So at this point in time, per our previous conversation, I'll make a motion to add to our next meeting further discussion regarding the medical assistant definition and statute and rule. Does anybody have a second for me?
Second.
Thank you, Mr. Rhodes. Any discussion? All in favor? Aye. Thank you.
Aye.
Thanks. Opposed? So moved. Our next meeting is December the 9th, 2020. And we are in room, conference room B at that meeting. And so,
just getting
at 12:30, I will make a motion to adjourn the meeting.
Second.
Thank you, Mr.
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So moved. Thanks, guys. And everybody have a nice Thanksgiving. And
happy Thanksgiving, everyone.
Thank you.
Enjoy the day, guys.